going to ever happen to you. So.
I'll just sit here.
Well, that's important, but just on the private business side. Hello.
I remember one day, Dave was only with us for 3 years.
What are you doing here?
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We're waiting for the amendment to Senator Foley's bill, Senate File 155, to be finished and Xeroxed. So we're going to start with Senator Higgins's two bills. Senator Higgins, can we start with your 2861?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be the one I'd recommend starting with first. And I think Ms. Quav, are you here?
Right here.
Madam Chair and members, last year we added two legislative members to the Gang and Drug Oversight Council as ex officio members, and I was selected as the representative from the Senate, and it's been an interesting experience. Being part of the council has allowed me to learn more about the council itself and the challenges that it faces. At the last Gang and Drug Oversight Council, some of the discussion was about the conflict of the mandated legislative report and the time in which the council receives the actual data that the report is drawn from. Under the current reporting requirements, the task forces would report to the council on January 31st, and then the council is supposed to have the report to us by February 1st. So, this bill would change the date by which the report is required to be at the legislature from February 1st to March 15th. And that will allow the council to get the information in and run the data and draft the report and have the council approve it. The council usually meets the first Wednesday in March of each year. And so that's a very simple explanation of a very simple bill. And Ms. Boisvert, the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs, can answer any questions that you might throw at us.
Okay. Senator Betzel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, if it's submitted to the legislature by March 15th, in many years that'll be getting a little later on in the session towards deadline times and so forth. It's going to vary from year to year, but would the information be significant or useful to the committees having jurisdiction over this area? I mean, the other option would be to move everybody's deadline back if we're trying to get it to us on time, because it may be too late for us to act on anything if it's too late for our committees, which is why a lot of reports are due in January when there's less going on here.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I think from my point of view anyway, I mean, the other option is to have incomplete information, have the information due earlier, which would likely mean that the information could be incomplete. But, and maybe Ms. Boisvert would have another
Chair,
point of view.
I think if everything were pushed back, not just our deadline, but everybody's deadline was pushed back, I mean, if it's critical to get it to us, that could drive it. But if it's less critical to get it to us, then March 15th might work. But just be aware that if there's an expectation that we may have to act on it when we get it, that may not be realistic. We may get it March 15th that 1 year and kick it over for action the next year. So I don't know what the expectation is when we actually get it. So,
Ms. Boisvert, is it possible to adjust the other deadlines, or are they locked in at that time for some particular reason?
Madam Chair and Senator, these grants are funded on a calendar year, and they report to us quarterly. We could report to you three quarters of data, which would be an incomplete picture for the year. That is another option we could do.
Senator Betzel?
I have one other. This is more of a question on the revisers part of it. Line 18 has an effective date of August 1st of 2008, which is normally when bills go into effect, they don't specify an effective date. So I'm just curious if we need the effective date to be August 1st of 2008.
Ms. Council?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, you're correct. This would be the effective date regardless, but I think we'd like to get into the habit of writing the effective dates, and especially for criminal bills, it's more important. But if you delete it, it wouldn't make any difference here.
Oh, well.
Do any members have any other questions? Okay. Senator Higgins, are you ready then to move your bill?
Sure, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 2861 be recommended to pass, and I think it just goes to the floor.
And referred to the Senate floor? On the consent calendar?
Oh, that works for me.
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. And then, Senator Higgins, I've been told that you should just, if you're ready, just can proceed with your second bill.
Is Judd here? Madam Chair, Chris Idy, who's the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, is in a hearing in the House.
Okay.
So if we get into a pickle, she will come here as soon as she's able.
Okay.
But I think that probably Mr. Forte and I might be able to handle it.
Well, Senator Higgins, if you'd rather, now that Senator Moy is back, we can proceed
to
another
bill?
Yeah.
Senator Higgins, I think that once you present the bill, Ms. Idy not being here is not, do you think that she's going to just be providing background information that we should have from all the testifiers, right?
So
why don't we proceed? And then if there is the critical question that that we need Ms. Idy for, we could just lay the bill over. But why don't we proceed?
All right. And we do have a handout, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2656 was heard in state and local government operations and amended. So we are working off the first engrossment. You'll want to be sure that you have that to work from. And I have with me today Rocco Forte, who is the Director of Emergency Preparedness at the City of Minneapolis. Members, I am the Senate co-chair of the Commission on Emergency Preparedness and Disasters, which we put into place in the last legislative session. And our group has been working through a whole lot of issues related to homeland security, preparedness, disasters, all those kinds of things. And one of the things that we found during the course of our work was that...
Well, Madam Chair, before we get...
Senator Betzel.
Senator Higgins mentioned a first engrossment. I don't know that we've got that. I think we've got the bills introduced. So I don't know that we've got the correct version in front of us.
Oh, I don't have any. I have four copies of it, if it will help.
Absolutely. Hang on a second.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Regina? I apologize for the mix up here. Members, can I just have Senate Counsel walk us through what the changes were, because I think it was pretty minor in terms of the difference from the as introduced to the first engrossment. So can you look at your the bill in front of you, 2656, and we'll have Senate Counsel walk us through what would have been in the first engrossment. Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair and members, the changes are page 1, line 8, if you delete, develop, and insert maintain, that would be one change. Another change would be page 1, line 19, delete June and insert September. So it would be September 1, 2008. And then the final change was that the committee deleted the section 2, the effective date.
And that would have been the first engrossment. Senator Higgins.
That's it. Okay, so I think I was in the middle of a sentence telling you that... one of the things that we learned in the commission was that even though Minnesota has a great certification program, we don't require our own state employees who work in that that area to be certified. And so this bill requires them to be certified. And then Ms. Ide's group, kind of the overall division of Homeland Security, would kind of track how everybody is coming along on their plans to get certified, and if they are not certified by the date specified, they would have to prepare and deliver a plan of you know, their certification progress and how long it will take them to get certified. And I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Forte to explain to us why what we require of our local governments should be done for our own state employees.
Thank you. Mr. Forte, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'd just like to start out by just going back to August 7th, 2007, talk about the bridge collapse for a couple minutes to show us the training that helped us prepare for that. We had 190 people in 107 vehicles on the bridge when it collapsed. As it collapsed, we had 121 victims that had to be triaged, treated, and transferred from the bridge. Basically, in order to do that, we also had fires on the bridge, and we had other incidents of hazardous materials that we had to deal with. So the emergency manager, who happened to be me in this case, had to coordinate the various disciplines from law enforcement, the fire service, hazardous materials, emergency medical services, health care, public health, governmental administration, public works, and public safety communications in the first 15 minutes of the event. In order to do that, an individual has to have a background understanding all these disciplines. Fortunately, the state of Minnesota has a certification program, which is only 250 hours, and in order to develop those skills in 250 hours, it is excellent education. But again, from my perspective, if we're going to put people in charge of these events, they should have the basic understanding of all those disciplines. This curriculum through the state of Minnesota gives us that. It also gives us the ability to work together and train together. These classes are given throughout Minnesota. I've had classes in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, Duluth, and Grand Rapids. It allows us to look at other communities and understand what their needs are. And through mutual aid, when we work together, we know what to bring to the site, and we know the language to use to talk to get resources. This program helps us understand the connections between the city, the county, the state, and the federal resources in order to minimize any incident we may fall into.
Senator Higgins, on line 1.14, the word developed. If we want to be consistent, do you want to change that word to maintain also?
Oh, I suppose, Madam Chair, because the curriculum is not being developed in this section. The curriculum has already been developed. So I suspect you're right on that. Thank you for catching that.
Senator Higgins, move that. And can you give us the line for the engrossed version?
Is it 1.14? First engrossment, it's line 1.14.
Okay. Delete developed and insert maintain. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. And then, Mr. Forte, can you share with us a little bit what the curriculum is that's been developed or is contemplated?
It's a handout, and I'm sorry.
Okay, all right. So we'll get some help to hand out the curriculum.
Yeah, go ahead and walk through that if you would.
Madam Chair, the curriculum basically has various courses and classes that emergency manager needs to be successful. It has all the national incident management classes, which basically, again, I'll go back to the bridge collapse. It was a federal bridge maintained by the state. It fell into a county river with the city of Minneapolis on both sides. By understanding the National Incident Management System, we're able to look at the incident rather than the jurisdictions, and we're able to manage. But this also has classes in leadership, influence, emergency planning, exercise design. It's a holistic course here as you look at the curriculum that allows you to go from preparing to response to getting our communities back to normal as soon as possible. It's a holistic program, if you will.
And, Madam Chair, some of the courses can be independent study done online, but others are done in a workshop or a classroom setting.
And Senator Higgins, I'm assuming that there's not any additional cost implications for the specifically identified members from each of the agencies to participate in this. There's not any other cost implications?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that there is any cost because many of our employees are already working their way slowly through this process, and some are certified, and it is, after all, our own certification process. So there shouldn't be an extra cost to that.
And then Senator Higgins,
I believe Mr. Turner looks like he has a fiscal note in his hand.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, I requested a fiscal note on Senate File 2656, and it came back saying that they do not believe the bill will result in any significant costs or require additional staff.
Very good. And then, Senator Higgins, can you share with us a little bit why the two different dates, why the September 1st, 2008, and then January 15th of each year?
Madam Chair, we wanted information this year, and we had originally put June 1st, and then in the last committee it was amended to September 1st. And I know that the legislature won't be around during that time, but our commission is ongoing. And if we discover outstanding issues surrounding the certification of our state employees, the commission could have some time to work on it. So we thought that it was appropriate to have it during the interim, this first report, and then after that it would be each year mid-January.
Very good. Any additional questions for Senator Higgins? Senator Higgins, is there anybody here in the audience who want to testify either for or against this bill?
Madam Chair, we just call him Judd. Judson Freed, who's the Director of Emergency Management at Ramsey County, has just joined us. And he's also past president of the Association of Minnesota's Emergency Managers. And he was helping work on this bill as well.
Do you like this bill?
I do, Madam Chair. Senator, thank you very much, and I apologize for being late.
Very good. Very good. That's all we need to know.
All
we need to know. Thank you for coming. Can you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Judson Freed, and I am the past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. The 400 members of our association represent the emergency managers for all 87 counties, the cities of the first class, a number of other jurisdictions throughout the state of Minnesota. And we feel fairly strongly that in order for there to be a successful response and recovery effort to any problem in the state, we all need to be on the same page, speaking the same language, and training is a good step in that direction. So, again, apologize for being late to your session.
We appreciate you being here. Senator Higgins, what's your desire?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2656 as amended be recommended to pass. I think it just goes to the floor.
Any discussions on Senator Higgins' motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Foley. Senate File 155. Yeah, we'll get him up there. And then I believe that we have our secretary, our state auditor is here. Please come on up. We're going to have Senator Foley will be at the table, but Rebecca Otto and Julie Roblowski are going to come and give us a brief overview.
Roblowski. W is V.
Roblowski.
Yeah. Thank you. I was raised
Irish.
Right. That too.
Which one of you would like to start? Ms. Otto? Actually, we'll probably have the overview, and then that way we can send you on your way unless you want to stay and hear the rest.
Sure.
And then we'll have Senator Foley present his bill.
Great.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair and members, glad to be here today. I'm going to do a very brief overview of our administrative penalty program special study. And I just want to give you, because I know you get a lot of paper, so I'm going to try to give you the nuts and bolts of the report. Senator Mua and Senator Foley requested our office conduct this study, and I want to quickly tell you some things that are important. First of all, we did a survey of local governments. It was a voluntary survey. We could not force them to answer. We sent out 900 surveys. 248 responded. 82% of the respondents were cities, 17% counties, so we got more from cities. We also, because of the response rate was somewhat low, we also did a brief review of news articles and websites. First of all, I want to just, as a review again, to give you what an administrative penalty is. They're used to enforce local ordinances through an administrative system that is separate and distinct from the court system. And the Minnesota Attorney General describes these procedures as intended to provide informal, cost-effective, and expeditious alternatives to traditional prosecutions for certain minor violations. Beyond these basics, administrative penalty programs are difficult to define or describe because the programs vary among local government entities. All right. Next, we looked at administrative penalty programs for both quality of life issues and traffic law violation issues. I want to go over the executive summary with you again just to kind of give you the highlights of the report. It was a very interesting report to conduct. Julie did a lot of the work, and we have some folks in legal that helped as well. What we found was that some local governments have implemented these programs to enforce traffic laws, and although differences exist in their operation, there were some common characteristics of all the programs, or a majority of them. All of the revenue collected is retained by the local government. The monetary fines are often less than the fines associated with state traffic tickets. Administrative penalties are not reported to other government entities and do not affect the individual's driving record or insurance. Administrative penalty programs are described as voluntary because violators have the option of accepting a state traffic ticket. There was another question of why. Why do they do this? And what we found, the most five common themes emerged, which were the belief that the distribution of fine revenues from the state traffic ticket between the state and local entity is inequitable, the need to generate revenue to replace LGA, that did come into the conversation or survey, the need to decrease court congestion, the desire to increase enforcement by giving law enforcement a cost-effective alternative to state traffic tickets, and finally, the desire to lessen the burden for the cited individuals. The question of revenue, some people said, is it a significant source of revenues? And what we found in our study with our respondents was that it does not appear to be a significant source of revenue for local governments if you look at their overall general revenues. But if you look at the revenue, if it's applied to a specific program, it could be viewed as significant. And for a specific fund, let's say Department of Public Safety. Now, 12 of the 30 local governments with administrative penalty programs for traffic violations, or 40%, said they designate the revenue for a specific purpose, and the most commonly designated fund was to support law enforcement operations. Okay. Now, let's see. So that's basically executive summary. I want to just say that the history is that the cuts in 2003 to LGA, these programs did crop up. In 2003, late 2003, the AG issued an opinion. There's a letter in here in the report towards the back to Representative Steve Smith and said that they could not do this. And then our office, went before I was there, issued a statement of position saying, no, they did not have the authority to do it in late December 2004. Our survey, there's a graph, I believe, on page 9 that shows that in 2004, the numbers went down, but they start to creep back up. We've seen further newspaper articles since then. We get news clippings, and we've found that there are more and more entities that want to enter into these programs. So I think the gist of the report is they're out there. I think they're on the rise. I know locals are communicating with each other in terms of sharing some information. We have some sample ordinances in here and language that's been adopted. And I think that clarification would be very helpful.
Thank you, Ms. Otto, and thank you for allowing us to call upon you to use the resources of your office to do this work. Ms. Verbaleski, would you like to speak on any of this, or are you here to just help us answer questions?
I'd think Rebecca covered. And I wanted Julie to have the experience of coming in front of a Senate committee. She's newer on her staff, and she's very good at public speaking, and so my hope is that at some point she can come and present in front of committees as well. So this is a good experience for her. One thing, too, that's very nice the way she's arranged this report is that we have the summation of the survey results, but then there's also some case studies. And if you read the case studies, they're really interesting because you can get a gist of why these things are happening, some of the attitudes out there. And I have to say that, and then we also have news clippings, but realizing that this is a very complicated issue, and it is multi-layered, and there's a lot of distinguished law enforcement folks behind us. There's law enforcement issues, there's revenue issues, there's quality of life issues within communities, and so it is, but I really hope that clarification can be achieved. So,
thank you. Any questions for Ms. Otto and her staff? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for being here. It's great to see you. This is an issue that has been communicated to me by cities, and actually I think a county in my district just voted to go down this road. And so I have some really mixed feelings about this. I've spoken to one judge in my district who talked about the increased fees, for example, to get a driver's license back after a DUI conviction, and how much, and I don't think that that's something that is addressed here anyway, but sometimes we're making it very hard for people when their insurance rates go up to get reinsured, and then when they get in another car accident, we have a lot of people who are going without insurance because they can't afford to get their insurance coverage back, so that's kind of an unintended consequence that penalizes future victims of so that's an issue. And then, of course, the cuts to LGA are, as you said, pushing people to look for other sources of revenue. So it's really hard to think on the one hand we're going to tell people that they can't have their sources of revenue, and then on the other hand we're not providing the revenue through a different source that they might need. But I also know from this judge on the other side of the coin that we want to have equal justice, you know, across the state, and the concern that some people might forego using the court system simply to keep something off their insurance, even, you know, that's kind of a heavy-handed approach to not take advantage of, say, fighting a bad ticket or something simply because of the concerns over insurance rates rising. So I guess I just want to let you know that this is a very difficult issue for me because we don't have really good answers to give to the communities who want to rely on this funding.
If there are no other comments, questions to Ms. Otto and her staff, thank you both very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for all the hard work that you did. Senator Foley, Senate File 155.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer the A3 amendment. I believe that members have a copy of that.
It's not it. Does everybody have the A3 amendment? Everybody, all the members have the A3 amendment. Yeah. Senator Foley, the A3 amendment is Senator Foley's amendment, but it is not an author's amendment. So he's going to talk about it, and we'll have a chance to discuss it with him. Senator Foley, the A3 amendment.
This is the meat of the Senate File 155, and what this does is put the chapter in the law back in the same form as it was before it was at the Transportation Committee. And did you want me to describe anything further on that?
Any questions for Senator Foley? Senator Orman?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, why should the Judiciary Committee take up the policy on this if the Transportation Committee has has voted. If you could just enlighten us a little bit about that.
All right.
Senator Foley.
Chair and Senator Ortman, this bill was submitted to transportation. I think it was an error. I discussed the matter with the chairman, Senator Murphy indicated that he supported my actions and that he wanted me to continue to pursue this, and so that's why I'm here.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, does this apply only to traffic enforcement, or would this also apply to administrative citations for scofflaws who get notices to repair their rental properties or something like that, and even though they get multiple notices that the repairs need to be done, they don't do them, and so then the municipality would impose an administrative citation because of
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, that does not apply. This is primarily related to traffic, Chapter 169, and that's where the Amendment 3, if you would look at that, give you an indication of where this comes from. But what you're looking at is speeding and stop signs and other types of traffic offenses. It could include driver license, insurance, depending on how the city ordinance is written.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Foley, I'm looking in the auditor's report on page 59, and I see that the ticketed offenses were building code violations, health code violations, animal violations, those kinds of things. So I guess I'd really like to know that this is only, not primarily, but only traffic. And maybe Mr. Backus can help
Backus.
Us on that.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, it's only traffic. You can see the section being amended is 169.022. That's the traffic code. And if you read the new language on lines 1.13 to 1.15, it talks about enforcing provisions of this chapter. So it only deals with Chapter 169 issues.
Okay.
Any other questions for Senator Foley on the amendment? Senator Betzel.
Just to be clear, the bill as it came out of transportation gives the authority to local jurisdictions to impose the administrative penalties, and Senator Foley's prohibits that, just so you understand what the difference is. Is that?
Yes, Senator Betzel, and what was interesting is that Senator Foley's language going to the Transportation Committee on Senate File 155 was his amendment. But in that committee, there was a delete-all amendment to his bill. That is the bill that's the engrossed version that's in our committee. And as the author of his bill, Senator Foley now would like to do an amendment to change the content that has come to us.
And I just want to understand how the bill changes from the first engrossment. I understand that
yes. This
would put the bill back originally as introduced or similar to that, which Senator Foley wants to prohibit administrative penalties, whereas the Transportation Committee deleted that to allow them, and now it's back here to prohibit them. Okay.
Yes, Senator Betzel. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am a big fan of Senator Foley's. But I think that if every time I didn't get the result I wanted in a committee, I could just go find another committee in a different group of votes to change a bill, well, first of all, it would be remarkable. But secondly, it would be a very good thing. I have to say the world changed for me yesterday because my 16-year-old son got his driver's license and he's on the loose.
And the rest of us too, Senator Ortman. Yeah,
can you tell us when he'll be on the road so we can be sure not to be?
He's probably a better driver than his mother. Okay. But the point is that the Transportation Committee had very passionate discussion about this. There were a lot of people that weighed in on this issue about why this is a transportation issue. And it's a transportation issue in my mind and not really a judiciary issue in my mind, because right now these cities can't issue citations when they find somebody, or wouldn't under this provision, would not be able to issue these citations if they found somebody who was in violation of the law. And so we would have to wait for the state citation. And that is a problem for safety in our communities. And so this is not a way to get around that. It is a way to support and add to the authority that local law enforcement has to stop people that they see that are violating the law. And that's their job. And I don't think it's about revenues. I think that it's about safety, and I think it's about making sure that drivers on the street follow the laws. And the local law enforcement are there to enforce those laws. And right now, if we went forward with Senator Foley's provision, we would be tying their hands behind their backs. And I think we want them to be successful at what we've hired them to do, which is to enforce the traffic laws. This is a transportation issue. No offense, Senator Foley. I don't agree with your amendment. I understand what you're trying to do. But I have to say that I oppose it and think that the transportation has weighed in and with very thoughtful consideration of this issue.
Well, Senator Ortman, Senator Foley didn't go shopping for a committee that was friendly to his issue. The Judiciary Committee requested for this bill to be re-referred to us because it had an impact on judiciary. And, in fact, the Judiciary Budget Committee has an interest in this, and so we wanted to have an opportunity to review the policy implications of this issue as it directly affects penalties for driving violations, which is squarely within the jurisdiction of this committee. So we had actually had the request to have this bill sent to us before the changes in the Transportation Committee took place. And now the bill has come to this committee, as it should, in that referral process. It is Senator Foley's bill, and he has asked us to consider an amendment to that bill. So I just want members of the audience who are watching this to know that Senator Foley did not go shop around for a committee to change his bill. But as the author, he's trying to shepherd this bill through to its conclusion. Any other discussions or questions for Senator Foley on the mechanics of the bill? Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, although this is a policy committee, I've learned years ago that at least policy committee should pay some attention to fiscal impacts. And you mentioned that there might be some judiciary budget impact to this. Do we happen to know what those would be if we passed it in either version?
Mr. Turner?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I will be requesting a fiscal note as soon as this hearing's over.
Okay.
It has to be an official bill for me to request one, so I'll request it on the second engrossment.
But Senator Betzold, without knowing the numbers, I mean, what would be the overall impact? I mean, if we allowed the administrative penalties, would that be less dollars going into the general fund? Is that how it would shape out then?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Senator Betzold, yes.
Okay.
Right now, with an administrative fine schedule, all the money goes to the local unit of government. Whereas, if it's a uniform citation, the state gets 2/3 plus the $72 surcharge. So the surcharge itself is quite significant. The fact that it doesn't get collected.
Okay. So, Mr. Turner, are you saying that it might be the opposite impact, and that it's not, instead of costing the state, it might actually be bringing revenues into the state?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
With the amendment. Okay.
With the amendment. Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Foley. And just so I'm, based on some things that have been said here, I'm not quite sure if I understand just a little bit the background of with or without this amendment and what that means. So I'd just like to ask a couple questions for clarification. Senator Ortman said, referenced the fact that local officials couldn't stop and enforce state law, and or at least maybe I misheard her, but that isn't the case, is it? I mean, this doesn't tie the hands of local law enforcement in terms of enforcing state penalties if we have your amendment in place, does it?
No.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this will not change the revenue part of it. This is what, with the A3 amendment, is what current law is. And an officer that witnesses a violation of a stop sign, we'll say, or a speeding or something of that nature, that there's nothing to prevent that person from doing what any other officer would do, and be to issue a citation indicating. I'm not trying to stop that from happening. What I want happen is to take the revenue that's currently through our work, and I admit that I had an initial significant part of that, where we kept increasing the fees. As you know, I was the author of the .08 legislation, and when I did that, I needed money to fill in with the fiscal note, and that's what we designated as money for fees. I don't like the fees, and I think that there are some bills coming along that will deal with that issue. But this thing, to say you're changing or doing any of that and reducing the revenue, this is not true. What has happened through the years is the state has the basic fine. And I can recall early on the state patrol gave up a portion of their money or was taken from them so that that the prosecutors could get some funding. And so this whole process here really is an indication of where we're handling the money that the prior legislators have set forth, and basically I have no objection to doing what all of these law officers are talking about doing, if they can provide some guidance in the law or guidance that says that we should do that.
Senator Betzel.
Well, I mean, we've got opposing views here, and I see we've got testifiers pro and against. I mean, voting on the amendment is essentially voting for one of the two versions, and it would seem to me that I'd like to hear some testimony for and against the proposals before I know where to vote. Is that what you're planning for then? Or
Senator Betzel, that's why we haven't voted on the amendment,
okay,
because I thought it would be an opportunity to hear testifiers.
Okay,
so.
Thank you.
Why don't we invite Mr. Gillespie and Mr. Sather up to the table, and then I'm going to have Senator Fischbach comment on this. Members, the delete all amendment that went on Senator Foley's bill in the Transportation Committee was Senator Fischbach's amendment, and she's here because we're having that discussion, and I'd like to give her an opportunity to speak on this. Senator Fischbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to explain that the language that you see in front of you was for my original bill. I can't remember the Senate file number, but, you know, they do separate things. So I'm glad that Senator Betzel pointed out that we should hear testimony beforehand because, you know, this was something the Senate did take a position on. It was in the transportation bill from last year. Senator Coring offered an amendment on the Senate floor, and it was added to the Senate transportation bill last year to clarify and allow the administrative fines by cities and counties. So do understand that, you know, in essence, the Senate does have a position on that, given that it was part of that transportation bill. And I think that the auditor pointed out that we do need to clarify this. And so either way is clarifying, but I think that we need to allow these cities and counties to do this, and we just need that clarification. And I think, and I appreciate your indulgence for letting me, and I'd be happy to answer questions, too, about the specific language. But I do think that we do need to make sure that we allow the cities and counties to do this so that we don't have the issue in front of us again over and over, because this has been several years, and there have been, I believe even the auditor mentioned before she even got here, it was, you know, the auditor before her had taken some position, the former or the previous Attorney General had to address the issue. And I think what we need to do is make sure that the cities and counties understand how they can do it and how they need to proceed through. And that's what my legislation would do, or actually Senator Foley's legislation with my language is how maybe we should say. But, you know, as for the financial part of it, I don't know if we would ever be able to tell how much, you know, there's some implication that it may increase the finances into the state. I don't know if we'd ever be able to tell that, because that would be if then someone would be pulled over and that police officer chose to issue that ticket. They may choose to, you know, give a warning or let the folks go, whatever the case is. So I don't, you know, to imply that there would be a windfall for the state is a little iffy, and I will wait to see the fiscal note. But I don't think we can say every dollar that they're making off of administrative fines right now is going to start coming into the state, because they may just choose not to even issue any, you know, issue a citation or anything, let the folks go. So I would appreciate, I am surprised that a committee would completely undo, completely opposite what was done in the Transportation Committee, and because that, my understanding was that is not generally what we do in the Senate. So I would like to see the language stay as it is and move on. And I think at the time when the delete all amendment went on, I think I did make the offer to Senator Foley to change authorship with him. So he wouldn't necessarily have to carry a bill like that he didn't agree with. But I really do think that it would be really changing the precedent and the tradition that we've set if a committee completely and opposite, you know, this is not just a small change that we're making in another committee. We're completely changing this entire bill.
It was a pretty small bill to begin with, Senator Fischbach. It's kind of hard to change only half of it when the answer is yes or no. Mr. Gillespie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We're the organization that represents about 8,000 line police officers across the state of Minnesota. The Board of Directors of the MPPOA opposes the use of administrative fines in lieu of traffic tags written under the appropriate state statute. The primary purpose of a local jurisdiction's use of administrative punishment is revenue enhancement. Make no doubt about that. This is about money, regardless of what anybody says it is. It's about money. We differ as to how that money should be applied, but this is about money, not law enforcement, not public safety. Those are red herrings. To assert otherwise is disingenuous argument meant to distract from the fact that local units of government retain the money paid by citizens for an administrative citation charged under an ordinance, while the state of Minnesota receives the lion's share of the fine and surcharges attached to the state statute. And again, this is all about money. Number two, the money raised by surcharges on traffic tag is used to support the police officers' Standards and Training Board Training Reimbursement Fund, which goes back to local units of government. When police officers issue an administrative citation for traffic, the surcharges is not collected. The local units of government and their representatives want two bites of the apple. They want the money from the reimbursement fund and all the money from the administrative fine. The argument that police officers do not write tags because they don't like the cost of the fine and the intended surcharge is specious. I can tell you, don't believe that anybody can tell you what all the police officers in the state of Minnesota think. I've been doing this for a lot of years, and I don't have a clue. I can tell you what my experience was in the tin can for St. Paul Police Department. I had no clue as to what the fine schedule was for Ramsey County District Court. It didn't matter to me. It's not my business. I'm there to look for traffic violations. If I see one, I write it, or I may give them a pass with a warning. How do we determine who gets a pass and who doesn't? Well, it's very simple. Attitude plays a large part of that, okay? And secondly, the severity of the crime, the severity of the violation. Somebody rolls the stop sign, that's one thing. If somebody blows the stop sign to 35 miles an hour, I'm not, the mercy booth is closed. Okay? That point. The argument that police officers do not write tags because they don't like the cost of the fine isn't applicable. It isn't relevant. The idea that speeding tickets are not written for violations of 10 miles over the speed limit is simply not true. Except for zero tolerance campaigns to eliminate dangerous driving, the grace factor is 5 to 7 miles per hour over the limit. I'm not revealing any secrets of law enforcement there. Everybody knows that. It's common knowledge that that's about what you can do. I can tell that because everybody does pretty much 72 miles an hour on Highway 169. Okay? Apparently the word has gotten out somehow. A car being driven 10 miles over the speed limit adds to the mass of the vehicle, making it a more deadly instrument in a crash, and police officers are the ones who respond to those accidents. And we're the ones who get to clean up the mess. The National Transportation Board lists right-angle motor vehicle accidents as the leading contributor to death and injuries sustained in motor vehicle accidents. And I don't know of any officer who simply refuses to issue a tag for a blown stop sign or semaphore. To suggest otherwise is both an insult to the integrity and decision-making of police officers and a threat to the state of Minnesota's authority to issue commercial driver's license. If you mask the commercial driver's license, the feds won't send, Uncle Sap won't send you the sugar. Okay? They're very clear about that. They're going to have an ability to withhold money from you, from the state of Minnesota. The concern about masking violations on driver's records remains unresolved. A traffic tag is a teaching tool, and it's not a means to generate money for the general fund for the state of Minnesota. It certainly was never intended to fill the purses of local units of government. However, a total of $63 million was transferred to the general fund from 2002 to 2006. That's $63 million in that period of time. The use of administrative fines threatens both the money for the post-reimbursement account and the general fund. And our problem with the money as in the post-reimbursement fund is that years ago I had a hand in the creation of the post-reimbursement fund. Yes, I am that old, even though I look youthful. We intended that money for one reason, and that was to have a stable source of income, of revenue, for police training. It had nothing to do with whether or not a local municipality or county could operate their general fund. That money was there for police training, and it was to be earmarked for police training. Citations written under administrative fines, no money, may go to the state of Minnesota for that fund, and we have seen it steadily decrease since 2002. Are local municipalities and counties using it for law enforcement training? I don't know. You don't know. And the folks who are proposing use of administrative fines, they don't know, because nobody reports this to anyone. They use it as they see fit. And they may use it for road improvement. They may use it for any other the programs they may have, but the money that that surcharge was originally intended for was for police training. The issuance of an administrative citation for traffic offense breeds disrespect for law enforcement. Imagine the dismay of one driver who receives an administrative citation costing $25 in a city while his brother receives a traffic tag for the identical offense costing $112 with a fine and surcharges in the townships surrounding the city, say White Bear Lake or White Bear Township or Forest Lake or Forest Lake Township. Most of the money goes into the general fund anyway and is a truly regressive form of taxation because it's not based upon a person's ability to pay. If there is a problem with the cost of fees and surcharges becoming so onerous that the public cannot pay them, the legislature should lower the fines and surcharges, but not direct where the money is supposed to be going. In an opinion issued December 1st in 2003, the Attorney General of the State of Minnesota issued an opinion that the local units of government are not permitted to usurp the powers reserved by the state in control of public behavior, especially the actions of law enforcement officers. They are also precluded from creating their own enforcement systems, inconsistent with those prescribed by statutes. The Attorney General assures our association that this is still the controlling opinion of their office. There is an important governmental purpose to prohibit the use of administrative fines for traffic purposes, traffic offenses. It is one of control and the important subfunction of control, that of reporting. No one knows who is using administrative citations because they don't report it to anyone. No one knows what they are charging for the benefit of a voluntary payment of a traffic offense that doesn't go on your traffic or insurance records. No one knows what they do with the money. The possibility for theft, corruption, or general mischief is ripe. There is no oversight by the state of Minnesota. And for these reasons, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association opposes the legislation permitting the use of administration citations for traffic violations and supports Senate File 155. Let's stand for any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Gillespie? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Gillespie, I've worked for a number of years to try and increase the dollars that go to the post board, and I have another bill this year that I hope will do the same thing. But there's been a shortfall in the post board funding for several years, and I wonder, isn't it the local cities that pay for the training if the post board is insufficient?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, that's presuming that you have an equitable disposition of the money. However, when only a few cities use administrative fines and the vast majorities don't, then there is, in fact, an inherently unfair system in place there where some folks won't get the money for training. And, in fact, it urges you to use administrative fines.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
That's really only because that's the current state of the law, where there's confusion about whether this is legal or not. But if we clarify in the law that cities can adopt this process, then any city can decide that they need these funds for whatever purposes. I don't believe this is about money. I know that you do. But if that's the case, then I think that the post board argument is defeated by the fact that the local communities are paying for training.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman. I'm not going to argue law with the attorney, okay? However, if as purported that this bill should pass, or excuse me, that the bill as offered by Senator Fischbach should in fact pass, then what you have in place is a direct conflict with both federal and state statute. The state statute says, and I don't care what you do with this law, then you have to change the other one, which says that the cities don't have the power to regulate this kind of behavior, that this behavior is reserved for the state of Minnesota when it comes to traffic enforcement. And the federal government says you can't mask driving records. So however you want to steer this thing through the committees, that portion of the law that you're talking about, which is if you say it's permissible, then the federal government may very say impermissible. Or the state might very well say that this portion of the law is, in fact, not correct. I don't want to use the term legal or extra legal because I'm not qualified to comment. But it's certainly not a correct reading of the law as it exists, according to the Attorney General, and she happens to be a lawyer.
Mr. Sather? Are you Mr. Sather? Or did I say your name correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Mark Sather. I'm with the City of White Bear Lake. I'm its city manager. I'm here today to speak on behalf of our city, as well as in support of the position of the League of Minnesota Cities. And in doing so, I'd like to speak in opposition of the amendment. I have a handout here that's from Bemidji, and I think it speaks to some of the comments by Senator Olson earlier. But I'd like to start out in part by somewhat respectfully disagreeing with Mr. Gillespie's comments beforehand. And in my opinion and the opinion of our city, this is not about money. It's not about dollars. And in further response to his remarks, I believe we are being genuine in making those remarks. I don't believe my comments could be construed as disingenuous. And I can perhaps help set the stage by giving a little bit of the history. In White Bear Lake, about 10 years ago, we started talking about this issue. And at that time, speeding, particularly on our residential streets, was the number one complaint received at City Hall, at our police department, and by our mayor and city council. With regularity, our city council meetings opened with members of the city council amending the agenda to add a discussion item to deal with speeding complaints on residential streets. And our police department became extremely frustrated because they felt that they were doing a reasonably good job taking the resources that they had, putting them in areas where they made the most difference, in areas where we had high accident rates and high public safety concerns. But it was at that point that we realized that speeding, particularly on residential streets, was more than just a public safety issue. It's a quality of life issue also, based on the number of complaints we had. And I'd have to disagree with the position of the MPPOA that 5 to 7 miles an hour is okay. We don't believe that. 5 to 7 miles an hour on a residential street, near a crosswalk, near a school, near a park, where there's children playing in the street, is a high level of speed. And yet, we find many times the motorist isn't aware that they're going down a well-designed road, that they're driving that fast. They can easily be going 5 miles over and not know it. So for years, our police department responded to that primarily with warnings. So some of the things that this bill is about, or this issue is about and isn't, masking is brought up a lot. And I'd ask you to keep in mind that in White Bear Lake, we have a policy, we have a procedure, and when people are issued a citation, they're given a brochure, and it talks about why we're doing it. But it also gives clear directive to the police department. This is to be used generally when tickets would not other or citations would not otherwise be issued, and in cases where the speeding is less than 10 miles an hour in excess of the posted limits. And as I said, many times the response to that. Now, obviously, if it wasn't a school crosswalk or in an exceptionally unsafe situation, a regular citation is issued. But when the motorist appears to have not even been aware that they were speeding, to get their attention better than what we were doing with a warning is we started to look at this procedure. We held a number of public meetings in our community in response to the complaints about speeding. And our police, in a sense, our citizens pushed back the notion that our police department was guided by a community-oriented policing process. They took great pride in it, our police department. And our residents were saying, then show us. Show us that you can respond to that. And it was actually through that process that they came up with, how about something in the middle? Now, we had been issuing administrative citations for a long time for what is generally considered quality of life issues. Junk cars, barking dogs, and things of that nature, piles of brush and so forth. But the question came up, could we issue those citations for minor speeding? We're a home rule charter city, and basically the underlying principle there is our charter is premised on the fact that our city council can pretty much do what the within the law unless specifically prohibited by the legislature. A lot of statutory cities can only do what the legislature specifically allows. And yet even there, and I believe the Attorney General raised a question on that and said that, you know, we'd have to look at probably all 100 and some other home rule charters to see how they would rule on that, and I think each charter is generally drafted different. But we started to institute this program about 10 years ago, and I'd like to give you a little bit more about it. As I said, it's applied primarily to residential streets, neighborhood streets, streets that have children walking to school, streets that have pedestrians walking on it, streets that have children occasionally playing in the streets. It was to get people to slow down. These were not bad drivers. These were people who just weren't paying attention to the speed limit, and we wanted everybody in our community to slow down. When we started talking about this, we had nasty letters to the editor saying, we're going to boycott your downtown if you start giving tickets to everybody who goes a couple miles an hour over the speed limit. That was the initial response to this. And then as the idea of something other than a county citation started to materialize, then we found that people seemed to accept that as a reasonable response, and it was implemented. Some of the components of it. We believe that it's responsive to citizens' concerns. It is an optional provision. That was recommended by our city attorney. I might add that our city attorney and I were asked to appear before the Council of Chief Judges many years ago when we first shortly after we started doing this. That's a group that meets here, I think, on a quarterly basis, and it's composed of representatives of the chief judges of each of the 87 counties in the state. They asked us questions about this. They had some concerns about where we were going. They had concerns about due process. But when we explained that part of our process set up a system where our city council appointed a county-trained hearing officer who is appointed specifically by the city council, is not an employee of the police department, is not subject to the police department's pressure. This was an independent entity. That seemed to address a lot of the concerns. The fact that it was optional. People can come in and pay this ticket if they feel that they were in violation and it was a reasonable finding. If they choose not to, the officer then can consider the circumstances and issue a citation under the state law or through the county court system. As I mentioned, with the direction of the city council as well as the police department, these are generally issued when tickets would not otherwise be issued. So the notion of masking, I think, is countered by that. If people are just given a warning, or as Mr. Gillespie said, if they're given a pass, that's not showing up on their record. That's not showing up on their insurance thing. That's not showing up in any other place. I think that this is actually a more accountable system. It's not about revenue. It's not about masking. It's not about generating disrespect for law enforcement. I can guarantee you in White Bear Lake, our community believes that the police department is, in fact, much more responsive because they're out there in the neighborhoods and they have slowed the traffic down. I can't testify today that all the problems have gone away. We still have some neighborhoods where there's complaints. We still have streets that we're working on other traffic calming methods and so forth to get people to slow down. But the number of calls has dropped substantially, and this topic has not been added to our city council agendas as often in the past. There is a penalty involved. In White Bear Lake, it's $40. Now, if I was given just a warning, as Mr. Gillespie mentioned, I might think, gee, I got a pass. But if I was driving 5 or 6 miles an hour over the speed limit and I got a $40 ticket, that gets my attention, and it causes me to think a little bit more about my driving behavior. The issue was raised that no one knows what cities are doing this. I think that's easily corrected. I think most cities that are doing it will indicate that and certainly could be required to. The amount of the fines. Our city council publishes those fines. First off, the procedure is established by ordinance, and the fines are established by resident or by resolution of the city council. Where it goes back to law enforcement. It goes into more traffic enforcement in our city, and that's public information. And I think in any city that's issuing citations, I don't think it leads to any other kinds of crime or corruption as tested. And then finally, just some statistics. Last year in White Bear Lake, there were 2,795 regular county citations issued. There were 689 administrative citations issued. Of those, 227 were for overtime parking in our downtown area. And the remaining 462, that included 53 other parking violations. These could be parking in crosswalks near a fire hydrant or something like that. 75 for snow removal. And 288 were for speeding on residential streets. So our total revenue averaged over the last 3 years has been about $15,000. It's not a moneymaker for the city. And yet it has really caused a lot of people to slow down. So I would respectfully ask you to vote against the amendment But I also would like to, I think it's been brought up by others, including the state auditor, that it would be helpful, I think, to everyone to get this matter resolved for once and for all and some clarification. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sather, I think you miss the what really happens when you have an officer out there. I can recall, and I only tell you this for illustration, but I spent 33 years on the state patrol. I spent 2 years as a deputy sheriff, and I've been a prosecutor for the last, since 1994. So what happens with a police officer that goes down and stop somebody for speeding, and I don't care what amount you say, what really happens is that someone is going 50 or 60 in a 40 mile zone, we'll say, and the officer can make this person feel real good because he'll give them a Dimmler amendment or whatever you call yours. And that way, the violator is happy. He didn't lose his license. He didn't have to pay more for his insurance or any of those kinds of things. But he still had the leverage to do it. So he lets some go, and he pinches some other. The whole process, especially with traffic violations, is a situation where you have to deal with how much is actually paid or whatever, and certainly you're not going to get too excited if you get one of those. Neither is anyone here in the room. It's nice to not have your insurance affected, so you pay more, and it certainly isn't a good deal where the individuals. Take and arrest for somebody for a variety of violations. And I know that with a $100 fine, it's pretty, or maybe it's 170, I think, is what they quoted us on the previous thing. That certainly is a deterrent, all right, but that makes the individuals very angry, and just as you indicated, there it's a very difficult thing to deal with, and I'm not trying to take your revenue away from you. I'm not trying to stop you from doing the things you have, with the exception I don't want you to take the money that's already been allocated to something else and earmark it for your own purposes, if you will.
Mr. Sather, the city of White Bear Lake, when they issued the administrative penalties with respect to the traffic violations, is there a database that you track those citations on?
Madam Chair, there isn't a reliable database. We have experimented with it. The idea in our city is you only get this once, and I'd like to say that we've got a great database that we can go back and do that. But I do know a lot of our chronic violators are people who are known by our police officers. As I said, these aren't people driving down Interstate 35E or 694. We don't patrol those streets. It's done by the county and the state. These are people driving down McKnight. These are people driving down Sierra or Carlisle. These are areas, again, in partly response to Senator Foley, These are areas when I mentioned the police were out meeting with the communities. We did covert radar enforcement in that area. You can put up little boxes or sometimes these signs that tell you how fast you're going. There's a radar thing that records that. 80% of the people were less than 9 miles an hour over the speed limit. But those were, in fact, the people who were causing the complaints. As I said, last year it was 27... almost 2,800 citations were issued for regular speeders. We're not easy on speeders. We're tough on them. But those people who fall in that 3 to 7 mile an hour range that were normally given warnings are now given an administrative citation. It gets their attention. And I can't say that every police officer remembers everyone that they give tickets to, but if people go through those neighborhoods, they are neighborhoods, and people tend to recognize the car or the driver. So I know a lot of people have been given one citation, and it didn't work, so they're given a regular one or one administrative citation. I'd like to say that we could show all the other ones, but it's not reliable data.
So, Mr. Sather, if there's no database to track, then I'm assuming that there's also no communication of these violations to DVS for their record keeping.
That's correct.
Mr. Gillespie?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to respond to a couple of points, and I have the highest respect for Mr. Sather. We've worked with each other for years. But first of all, I disagree with the disrespect. It's not intra-city. It's extra-city. If you're a highway trooper and you're dropping $112 stop sign tags in the city of White Bear, or if you're a county employee dropping $112 tag in the White Bear Township, it is an entirely different. It breeds disrespect for the law enforcement because folks begin to talk about why it is I got a $30 tag in White Bear, but it cost my brother-in-law $112. That's the disrespect. That's the disingenuous part of that argument. And then secondly, the reason that administrative tags are popular among police officers in certain locations is no court. Don't have to tie up my day with a court case. It's a voluntary compliance. There's no going to losing my day. I could play golf. I can go fishing. I can do whatever I want. And my purpose is served. The problem is it's not voluntary. It's coercive in nature. You have a choice. You can either pay the $30 or $40 fine or contest it and take a chance on ruining your day and not going to work and, in fact, going into court and taking a shot at a $112 fine. So it's not voluntary by no any stretch of the imagination. It is no different than if a police officer issues a warning. It's a better deal for the driver all the way around. It's not as good for the rest of us, the public and the insurance agents, insurance companies, and the federal government, which is trying to produce some documentation about driver behavior. The idea that you don't write any 3 to 7 mile-an-hour tags, not entirely true. I mean, the rule is pretty much if people, it depends on the time of day. And we don't tag, that's right, we don't tag during the time people are going to work. We don't tag them when they're coming home from work. There are all sorts of rules in there. But you write a lot of 3 to 5 mile-an-hour tags for burglars and robbers and thugs and drug dealers, and I used to empty my tag book on those folks because I wanted my burglars walking for one reason. It's a little hard to carry a safe if you're on foot. So I know that where they are. So there are lots of reasons in it as to why someone would perhaps issue a tag and someone would not issue a tag, and it has nothing at all to do with the fine schedule.
Well, members, as much as I enjoy this back-and-forth conversation between Mr. Gillespie and Mr. Sather. I think that issue here is a very important policy discussion for us. I think the Attorney General's office have spoken and the State Auditor's office have spoken that under current law, local government can't write administrative tickets. And I think that, the reason why this bill is in this committee is for us to have that discussion on whether or not we want to change current law to allow that to happen. Because I think that it's a different discussion. It's a different discussion. And it's a very serious discussion. If we want to move in that direction. And so, it is not an issue of the different law enforcement and the cities fighting with each other about who gets the money. and it is not an issue of Senator Foley's bill versus Senator Fischbach's amendment. It's a very critical discussion for us to talk about because the State Auditor's Office has come back with their conclusions and the Attorney General's Office have sent out a response saying that current law says that local government can't be writing administrative penalty tickets on traffic violations, which is the prerogative of the state. And that state law preempts that. And so I think that, I think that's the policy discussion for us to think about. And if we want to move away from that, then we need to have that discussion and let 155 go, and then we'll have to fix up some other things. But if we want to reinforce current law, then I believe that's what the A3 Amendment does, is that it reinforced what we have in current law. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, with all due respect, we can change the law. I mean, I think that's what Senator Fischbach's amendment did, and I think that's what the entire Senate voted on last year, was to change the law to allow the local communities to use these administrative penalties. We are trying to authorize this, and we did it last year. And so we do have the power to change the law. We have said we wanted to. I hope this committee will say that we still continue to want to do what we voted for last year. I don't know that anything has changed, except that there are an awful lot of communities that believe that there is the public will to change the law. And so with all due respect to the Attorney General and the auditor here, what they're advising is we need to change the law to be consistent if we want to allow this to happen. I think that's what Senator Fischbach accomplished last year, and I hope that the members will vote to maintain what was accomplished and passed by the Senate last year, and with all due respect to Senator Foley, to vote no on his amendment at this time.
And Senator Ormond, I'm not going to speak to what happens in another committee, but we are the Judiciary Committee, and I think that we should think about the implications of this in us moving down the road of whether or not we're going to give up an area of the law that is within the exclusive jurisdiction of state law for the purpose of creating uniformity across this state among different municipalities and local governments. If we want to go down the path of giving up different areas of jurisdiction, I think that that's a very fundamental and very serious question for us as a Senate Judiciary to think about. And I, for one, think that we are people who are very smart, who take our jobs very seriously, and that's why I think that outside of the discussion about the financial implications or otherwise, for me, what's critical is to have this committee have a discussion about whether or not we want to move in the direction of explicitly giving up an area of state jurisdiction, specifically traffic policy, traffic law, to local government. So, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think appreciate what you said very much, and I don't think it's really different than what Senator Ortman said, except that I agree with you that there are serious policy considerations that we can change the law. But as the Judiciary Committee, I think we have the responsibility to talk about whether that's good public policy or not and what some of the implications may be. And I'm looking at this editorial, which came from my hometown paper, the Bemidji Pioneer. And in the third paragraph of that, kind of cuts to the chase of what some of those policy implications are. It says, Bemidji and Beltrami County officers, realizing the financial status in this area in the first place, are more likely to issue verbal or written warnings rather than state citations. People can't afford the high fines and don't pay, leading to a large backlog of warrants and so forth. So, on the one hand, the policy implication is that for these low-level fines, we're allowing local jurisdictions to take more local control over those issues and kind of second guess maybe what the state has decided would be appropriate penalties. On the other side of the coin, we have the need for uniformity. And then perhaps, especially in my mind, when we're dealing with teenagers, we maybe have some safety issues as well in terms of tracking their driving records and wondering if they're learning what they need to learn before we put full driving privileges in place for them at a particular age. So I don't know if that's been talked about or thought about at all, the need to maybe treat younger people differently than more experienced drivers. But I think that those are some of the policy implications that we would be looking at.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your comment on that you wanted to have a full discussion and understand what's going on with this and make sure that we all know the differences in the bills. And I think that given that information, I think there are other folks in the audience who want to testify and maybe have a few comments. We've heard from these gentlemen here, there might be some other folks that want to make some comments if you would indulge them.
I'm not opposed to having people give testimony to help illuminate the issue, but I'm wondering if any more testimony is necessarily going to add to the discussion, and I hope that if you feel strongly that it will in some way, I'm open to that, but I hope you will indulge me in the interest of time that I think that both witnesses have presented the case well for and against, and I'd like the committee members to have an opportunity to have the discussion in the time remaining that we have on this issue. We do have a very full agenda, and we do need to move on to other bills, but I know how important this is to both Senator Foley and Senator Fischbach, and I think it's important for committee members to be able to ask questions or, talk about the issue.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I understand the need for uniformity in how we apply the law. But I'd argue that I don't think it's applied uniformly anyway. I got a warning for excessive speed late last summer. I was wearing my baseball cap and not my wig. I mean, on purpose. I didn't quickly whip it off and, do anything. But I felt that the highway patrolman felt some sympathy for me or something, this little old lady who's lost her hair, speeding. I didn't cry.
He
even offered me an out. He said, "Did you just kind of forget you were going fast?" And I said, "No, I'm late." So I was this dumb little old lady, but he was very sweet, and I got a warning. But that's not equal enforcement, because somebody else, maybe my son driving, would have gotten the ticket, that kind of thing. So there isn't 100% uniformity. I know citizens have a right to expect some uniformity, but to be really honest with you, this is the surcharge, a function of it, and I understand it, and I think it's outrageous what we've done with the penalty. And Senator Higgins is telling me about the hole this causes if we, I understand that, but I think our communities are trying to fight back, and they at least should get a bigger share. We're not going to do that. So I'm going to kind of err on the side of our local communities, I'm afraid.
Any further discussions on the A3 amendment? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, one of the significant programs that came out of this I think is important for the members of the committee to know about, and that was, I think it was Wright County, but I'm not sure, and I'm sure there's somebody here in the audience that can testify, about what they did with this money was to create traffic school for violators, and they paid for local programs to further educate some of the violators, and I don't know whether there's someone who can testify about that, but I was pretty impressed with what they've done with these funds to improve driving in the counties. I mean, these funds have made a significant impact in terms of safety for the residents.
Any further discussions on the A3 amendment? Senator Foley renews his motion to he moves the A3 amendment. Senator Foley, any further discussions? Any thoughts?
I would ask for a vote on that, and if it passes, that it be sent to the floor.
Well, it's hard to just. Madam Chair,
this is just on the A3 amendment. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All the opposed, say nay.
No.
No.
Motion prevails.
Roll call.
Or division.
It's a division.
Division.
All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please raise your hands.
That would be three. We just talk louder.
You're kind of loud.
All those opposed, please raise your hands.
Two, three, four, five.
There being five no's and four ayes, the amendment does not prevail. Senator Foley, what is your wish for Senate File 155?
Lay it on the table.
Senate File 155 has been laid on the table. Thank you. Well, members, on Thursday, you will all have an opportunity to help our local law enforcement. We're going to peel back all those fees. I hope that that bill passes this committee unanimously. Plus, I hope you all know that one of the reasons why this is happening at the local level is because of the cuts to LGA. And so this better send the signal that if we're willing to go this distance to help local law enforcement, recognizing that they're short in resources, I sure hope that we do something about LGA as well as rolling back those fees this session.
Well, I was pretty darn close.
Senator Betzel, I think your bill is up.
Okay.
Oh, no. 43. And then estimated.
That's interesting. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2309 has a bit of history here. And in order to understand the bill, I'd have to give you just a brief description of the history here. This bill has come to us from the Commerce Committee. A couple of years ago, this committee spent quite a bit of time looking at the issue of identity theft and specifically the use and misuse of Social Security numbers. And Senator Steve Kelly actually carried some rather comprehensive legislation to try to define what could and could not be permissible uses of the Social Security numbers. And the first engrossment, which I believe you have, indicates what a person or entity may not use a Social Security number for. Just to make sure that people had sufficient time to make these changes and so that the legislature could also revisit them, we delayed the effective date by about 3 years. So it was going to go into effect July 1st of 2007. About a year ago, the banks and credit reporting agencies indicated that the way that they read our law would make it very difficult for them to issue credit reports to Minnesota consumers. Because if you didn't use a Social Security number, it would be very difficult, for instance, to identify which, for instance, Mary Olson we're talking about if you didn't have a unique identifier in there. I don't think that many of us read the law that way, but as long as they were saying that they could not issue credit reports, at least the way that we customarily have them, something had to be done. Now, last year there were bills introduced in the House and the Senate to deal with this. The Senate bill was not moved. Nothing happened with the Senate bill. The author just did not do anything with the bill. I was not the author. In the House, they actually spent quite a bit of time on this issue and, in fact, put a very comprehensive package together, which we saw for the first time in the Data Practices Conference Committee. And we were then asked to be voting on something that had a lot of information on Social Security number use that the Senate had absolutely no position on. So what we did in the Data Practice Conference Committee, which, by the way, Senator Olson chaired, we just extended the current deadline from July 1st of 2007 to July 1st of 2008 for the current law. And I foolishly said then that I would work on the issue, which, you know, they remembered. And so actually they came on knocking on my door, and we did spend, and I know a lot of stakeholders did spend quite a bit of time working this issue. The bill that was then introduced as 2390, the way it was introduced was exactly what passed the House last year. I figured, well, let's just introduce it that way. I'm not wedded to what the House did, but at least that's a starting point. And so then this bill went to the Commerce Committee, and by the time it got to the Commerce Committee, it was amended down to what you see as the first engrossment. And I'll briefly walk through. This is all that is left from what, again, what the House had as a rather comprehensive package here. If you nothing has changed on page one. On page two of the first engrossment, on lines 2 to 8, it says that you cannot use a Social Security number as a primary account identifier that's identical to the Social Security number, except in conjunction with an employee or member retirement or benefit plan. This is something that's been requested by the life insurance companies because, in fact, they do use Social Security numbers as the identifier for their policy holders. So they have requested that, and apparently that's, most of the stakeholders believe that that is appropriate. The real fix that we're talking about for the credit reports appears on lines 2.10 to 2.14, and this language doesn't prohibit the disclosure of a Social Security number to third party if it has no independent economic value to the seller or is incidental to a larger transaction, which these reports are, and if it is initially collected for the purposes of identifying the individual. This is the language that we believe fixes the prohibition of selling Social Security numbers. And this is the crux of the issue that, as again, drove from the credit reporting agencies. There's two other minor issues that are within this bill on lines 2.22 and 23. It says that a person or entity must restrict access it holds so that only, current law says only employees who require the numbers in the performance of their job duties. But it turns out that there are many employers that subcontract out their payrolls, as an example, to somebody else. And it'd be very difficult for a party who's a contractor handling payroll as an agent to do the payroll if they didn't have access to the Social Security number. So there may be agents or contractors who need access. And then the effective date for this section is July 1st of 2008, which is, again, 1 year after the original law went into effect. Section 2 actually is just some cleanup language because the current law talks about this section does not prevent the use of a Social Security number as required by state or federal law. There is nothing in state or federal law that requires the use of Social Security number. It's either authorized or permitted, so it's actually a bad term. There is an A2 amendment that Ms. Pontius caught that we should make Section 2 effective July 1st, 2008 as well because that's part of the whole larger bill. So this is just a technical amendment, the A2 amendment. So I'll move the A2 amendment simply to make Section 2 effective July 1st of 2008.
Question, Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, July 1st is kind of an unusual date for an enactment date. Why is July 1st the date? Do you recall?
Senator Betzold.
I don't recall. The original law, and Ms. Pontius can help us out here, the original law went into effect on July 1st of 2007, or was supposed to, and then we delayed it exactly for 1 year. I don't know whether there were fiscal issues that drove that or not. I just don't recall right now.
Ms. Pontius, do you recall?
Madam Chair, no, I don't recall why it was July 1 instead of August 1.
It may have tied into some federal laws, too, because of the federal fiscal year actually starts later, so I don't know.
Anybody in the audience have the answer to that question? Mr. Neumeister?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. In 2005, the original bill was passed, and there was a language that was repealed last year, and it dealt with the selling of Social Security numbers. So there was a two-year allowing companies to be able to work out the differences and all that That's why the July 1st, 2007 effective date.
So why was it July 1st? That's the question.
No. That's just the point they picked out, July 1st. You know, I'm just telling you that that's more of the rationale.
So somebody somewhere picked out July 1st, 2007, and now that's why we end up with July 1st, 2008.
Right.
Senator Lemire, does that answer your question?
Yes.
any discussions on the A2 amendment?
That might have triggered an oral amendment from Senator Lemire. Has it triggered an oral amendment from you?
No. No, I just want to get along here.
On the A2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel, any questions to Senator Betzel on the bill?
Well, I know Senator Lemire has some issues. He shared them with me a little earlier, so I think Senator Lemire needs it.
Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, we had a discussion earlier about some of the language that was involved in the Senate language, in the Senate, the early Senate language about not just the sale of Social Security numbers, but also the leasing and loaning and possible trading or renting of individual Social Security numbers. And I see that that's not part of this particular bill. And I was wondering if perhaps the sponsors of this bill had a reason why that was omitted.
Senator Betzel.
Yeah, Madam Chair, again, there are many, many, many people who worked on this over interim, and some of them are here right now. And the bill that the House passed last year and put in the Data Practices Act, and the bill that was then as it was introduced, had some language. It prohibited, for example, and I think that it had some new language that said that you could not lease, loan, trade, or rent an individual Social Security number to a non-affiliated third party. That, again, was in the bill as introduced from the House last year. As I understood it in the various meetings, which I was not participating in over the interim, there was a lot of confusion over that particular addition from the House, because they weren't certain what that actually meant. So that is the reason why it is not part of the bill as you have before you, even though that is what passed the other body last year.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Lemire.
I'm trying to recall myself, and I think perhaps the discussion was around the idea that if one wanted to get technically around this law, and if you didn't say loan or rent in the law itself, could one get around this law by simply conveying that information, a Social Security number, without a formal sale, but you could rent or lease or convey it in a different way? And could this possibly have been comfort language to prevent that conveyance?
Well, Senator Betzel.
Again, Madam Chair and Senator Lemire, there are people here who monitored what would happen in the other body last year where mm-hmm. this language was originally adopted. They were part of greater discussions that went on this past fall on that particular point. Maybe I'd invite them to come on up to. I mean, they had expressed to me a concern that that language is just too vague, and perhaps they may want to step forward and explain why they what their concerns were, because I wasn't part of those meetings. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Girard Associates, and I'll attempt to answer on behalf of the Fair Information Practices Coalition, which is a group of a very large group of different businesses and trade associations who have been working on this issue and other issues related to privacy. And the lease loan trade issue was part of a much larger bill from last year that attempted to not just clarify existing law, which is what this bill is attempting to do, but brought with it a lot of other issues. And as you will see, if you look at the original bill that Senator Betzold had, which reflected the language that was passed in the House on the in the Data Practices Bill, it then resulted in a lot of additional language that required significant clarification, and that's why you'll see so much other language, because the idea what we're attempting to do this year is to address address some issues that have come up about current law that has not gone into effect, clarify those issues, and so that the law can go into effect. And then to the extent that there's other discussions, you know, after that, I think clearly those issues may yet come forward. But those terms, again, as Senator Betzold said, do raise a lot of other issues that require considerable additional clarification.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Lamar.
Ms. Cook, if we just stay focused on the term of sale, I would tend to think that that in and of itself will cause a need to clarify, because then the question would be is, can someone convey this information? Social Security numbers, by the way, are kind of the keys to the kingdom. If someone wants to know everything about you, whether it's about medical records or data, financial information. And I would hate to think that we would miss that possibility by simply referring and isolating ourselves to simply the term sale. And I think if that language was included in this bill, that would at least make it clearer to the reader that we don't want, or we want to make sure that nothing is conveyed in the way of a Social Security number in any type of formal transaction, whether it's sale or an additional other type of conveyance. And I think having that reference makes it at least a little more, a clearer parameter to the conveyance of this information. Wouldn't you agree?
Senator Limmer, those terms bring with them a lot of other issues that would need clarification. And so the attempt, again, was to clarify what is currently in law with respect to sell, which begins on line 2.11. And I think that if you read the whole, what's on the books right now, it is very extensive in terms of what can be done or not done with a Social Security number totally, whether it's sold or otherwise. And there are it's very strict. In fact, we've been told it is one of the strongest consumer protection laws in the country with respect to Social Security numbers. No other state has gone this far in terms of regulating the use of a Social Security number in commerce. And I think one of the important things to remember is that, as you said, it's the key to the kingdom. It is also, in terms of the business community, the key to helping us prevent identity theft, which is why it is so important that we don't interfere with the use of Social Security numbers in business transactions. For example, a financial institution has to make sure that the person in front of them is who they say they are, and the Social Security number is the way that they do that. And I think we don't want to be in a situation where we're interfering with the ability of the business community to make sure that, in fact, the person in front of them is who they say they are, and use that as an important tool to prevent identity theft.
Madam Chair,
Senator Lumber.
I'd like to introduce the A3 amendment, and council has it. It's about this very issue, making and recognizing the terms lease, loan, trade, or rent an individual's Social Security number to a non-affiliated third party. And I can explain the amendment a little bit more in detail, Madam Chair.
The commissioner may do this in this
Senator Lamar, you can start explaining the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had this discussion about whether or not we include the terms lease, loan, trade, or rent in addition to the language that's in the bill referring or isolating it to the sale. I believe that information, if we don't have clear language in how we reflect a future conveyance of a Social Security number, there may be some people with less virtuous intent that could gain that information other than the technical word of sale. Non-affiliated, of course, makes reference to a term that's kind of been used more in federal language. Affiliated means you can transfer intimate information on a customer if your umbrella corporation has an affiliation with another corporation, if you have a business relationship through ownership. you can share information. Federal law allows that. I believe state law allows that. But when it comes to a non-affiliated third party, we're recognizing that if it's a non-affiliated, meaning it's not associated with an umbrella corporate relationship, that we would just simply be referring to the language saying that not only sale, but any other type of conveyance that we can think of, like a lease or a loan or a trade or a renting of that information, would have to be recognized or not recognized.
Senator Limmer, just for my own information, how does somebody rent a Social Security number?
Well, I think the question is could it or could it not be? I don't know. But if we have this covered, at least we're preventing that. It's more of a comfort language, Madam Chair, than anything else.
Senator Betzel?
Well, I think we've got people here who can certainly address the issue better than I can, but I'm not sure what these terms mean or the consequences here. My concern last year and my concern again this year is the fact that the banks and the credit agencies are already incurring costs right now with the assumption the legislature is not going to change the law or extend the deadline. So, I really see an urgency to fix what we have to right now. And what Senator Limmer is discussing probably deserves, further discussion and debate. And I think when we first looked at the Social Security issues a few years ago, we recognized this was not just a one-time bill. This was going to be something we were going to be talking about for quite a while to come. And this is one of those issues that probably merits some more. And, in fact, I'll be more than happy to pass the baton to Senator Limmer and let him have the next round at it. But as far as this bill goes right now, I think I'd rather not venture there. But it's not to say that it's not an important issue. It's just that it complicates things and could lead the bill to, be delayed when I'm trying to get it through as quickly as possible to fix this thing before we get too far in the process. But I think Mr. Tennyson has some thoughts on this particular member as well, too.
Mr. Tennyson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm with the law firm of Tennyson Law in Minneapolis. I represent Reed Elsevier, the Jones Lexis Nexus, and some other companies. The amendment that Senator Limmer proposes ventures into a whole new area and would preclude many of the legitimate activities that currently go on, and I'm not sure that's what he intends to do. If the term affiliated or non-affiliated is what he, I'm not quite sure what he means by that, if he's using the Gramm-Leach-Bliley definition or not, but clearly many of the activities that are legitimate under current law and which are necessary to carry on many business activities are between unaffiliated parties. And if you say that you can't lease, trade, or rent to an unaffiliated party, I'm not sure first of all, I don't know what the necessary lease, loan, or trade or rent adds to the sale. But if it means something, then it would preclude perhaps what we already do and what we're trying to continue to do, because it protects the public and institutions from fraud. For example, my client provides verification information to financial institutions to preclude fraud. And as to make sure that, as some of the examples before, Mary Olson is the Mary Olson that we're talking about, not somebody else. We provide that information to companies that purchase a service from us. And that's necessary for financial institutions to carry on their activity. I'm not sure what lease, trade, rent, I don't think that's the sale. In a way, if you go back to the definition or the language that Ms. Cook pointed out already, I get the right version here, in clause 7, it clearly means that the sale, we're talking about a sale basically, and the we intend that this should let us continue to transfer and disclose information under that sale. And if Senator Limmer, your amendment is to preclude that, then I think it's in opposition to what we're trying to achieve in this bill. But I'm not clear what you're trying to achieve.
Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Tennyson, your words were in describing Clause 7 as we're talking of a sale here, basically. I think that was your words, a sale. If you referred to it as something else, like a lease or a loan, does that technically get someone off the hook and not prohibit the protection of these Social Security numbers of our constituents?
Mr. Tennyson.
Senator Lemmer, I don't know of anybody that does a loan or a lease or some kind of a transaction like that. I just don't have that kind of knowledge. Perhaps
Senator Scheid.
I don't know. I'm not sure what we're talking about there, Senator. I think we're conjuring up something that doesn't occur. But.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think that what Senator Lemmer is trying to accomplish here is to preclude someone from saying, well, I'm not selling it, I'm leasing it. And I understand that concern. I can just tell you I know what this bill has been through to get here. And I think those words will bog it down again. I think they're probably worthy of exploring that and having separate legislation, but I think I can't imagine this discussion. It can't be resolved by July 1st, 2008, I'm guessing. We've struggled all this time just over selling and to get to this language. So I don't think I can support your amendment now, but that doesn't mean I wouldn't in the future. I think am I right about what you're trying to prevent, Senator Lemmer?
You're correct.
Ms. Cook or Mr. Tennyson, in the industry, and maybe Mr. Tennyson, is there an incident where a Social Security number or a bunch of Social Security numbers would be leased or loaned or traded or rented?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any. In our transactions, as I understand the extent of our transactions, our transactions are among businesses. Our customers are businesses. And they purchase that information from us.
Ms. Cook?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am not aware of any instances. And I just want to remind everybody that when this was originally passed in 2006, we all thought that sell was abundantly clear. And obviously it's not, based on an interpretation from the consumer reporting agencies. And I think we would once again run into a similar issue with lease, loan, trade, or rent, which, as we said, we don't think anybody's using those terms now, but are sufficiently ambiguous that someone could turn around and interpret those as saying, well, actually it's not a sale when they give you the consumer report. It's a lease or a loan or a trade or rent. And so I am concerned because of the interpretations we've got from lawyers who aren't in this room. And if they make a decision that we can't get credit reports with full Social Security numbers, it is going to hamper the ability of all sorts of folks in the business community to be able to protect people against identity theft by having the information that they need. So I understand Senator Lemmer's concern, and we're happy to continue working with him, but we're quite concerned that those terms are going to create similar issues to what we have with the word sell, which at the time we thought was abundantly clear.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, a question. If they aren't currently sold now, it's because somebody who's looking for a credit report would waive, right? They would waive the right to the protection. They would authorize somebody to release a credit report. And so I think Senator Lemmer's distinction is probably a good one, because you've either been authorized or you haven't been authorized to release that information. And so I worry, like Senator Lemmer does, that the word sell means not these other things. It could be interpreted by crafty lawyers, if you will, that it means not to lease. So a lease would be okay, or rent would be okay. And in the industry, I don't know about the credit lending industry, but in industries, we see an awful lot of lists, customer lists and databases being rented or leased or borrowed with no ramifications. That information is passed along all the time for no reason. And if we don't prohibit that, then what's to stop someone from saying it's not a sale, and so it must be authorized or allowable under the statute?
Senator Betzel. I can only concur with what Ms. Cook said. I would have never thought that the language that we enacted, that a party cannot sell Social Security numbers obtained from business in the course of business. I would never thought that credit reporting agencies would have read that sentence to say that they cannot release credit reports to Minnesotans with Social Security numbers. But that's exactly what they did, and that's what caused the bind that we're in right now. And I don't know what is going to happen if we adopt the A3 amendment, if somebody else is going to come up with some other reason or excuse to mess everything on up. And then if this goes into effect on July 1st of 08, we really do have a problem. We were only able to keep these credit reports coming into the state because we were able at the last hour last year to extend the deadline. Again, I'm certainly willing to, if Senator Limmer wants to introduce a bill or wants me to work with him on it, I'll be happy to do it. But I'd like to just get the bill moving and address the one issue I know has to be addressed, and then let's work on the other ones and see where it leads on it. Because if nothing else, Senator Scheid's committee may want to see this bill back if this amendment goes on. I don't know.
Senator Limmer renews his motion on the A3 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, in earlier versions of this bill from last year, there was a discussion about what do we do if our privacy laws are violated? What is the penalty? Is there a remedy clause? We don't have anything of that nature. It's been strangely missing out of this version of the bill. I'd like to move the A4 amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer on the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we talk a lot about data privacy. We talk about it all the time. But quite often our data privacy laws in all of the robust language we use in protecting consumer rights and consumer protection, we strangely kind of forget the penalty or remedy clause in the event that that is abused or that law is broken. Some of the versions of this bill that were found last year had this clause, Subdivision 6, as it's noted on the A4 amendment, recognizing a public or a private penalty and remedy if one violated this section of law. I'm trying to remind the legislature that we're here to protect the citizens, and in the event that there is a violation or an abuse of the misuse of Social Security numbers, that people should be held accountable. And I believe this is vitally important for the protection of data privacy for our citizens.
Senator Limmer, can you describe briefly what the penalties, what the remedies are under Section 8.31?
Well, I know it's a cause of action. I don't have that. Perhaps counsel
Ms. Pontius
could share with us.
Madam Chair, members, this is kind of a generic statute that applies. It's an attorney general statute that applies to a number of different violations of consumer type protection laws. It specifically lists some statutes in it, and a number of other statutes have language like this that just make it clear that the statute does apply. The Attorney General has enforcement powers under the statute, discovery powers. There's a power to get injunctive relief to prohibit a practice, and then there's also a private remedy where an individual who's injured by a cause of action can, or injured by a violation can bring a civil action and get damages along with reasonable attorney fees and injunctive relief. So it has a number of different remedies under it.
Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, I've got some concerns about this. I mean, we are making a shift into an area where, you know, we don't want consumers to needlessly disclose their personal identification, including Social Security numbers. However, there's times when they have to do it, and it's going to be confusing for consumers, and it's going to be also confusing for some businesses that are right on kind of the border and trying to figure out, am I supposed to ask for Social Security numbers? Can I use them? Can I not? And there's going to be, you know, times when individuals and businesses and organizations, frankly, you know, mess up. And, you know, and I think leaving this in the hands of the Attorney General's office for the time being is appropriate. I think that if, as the law goes into effect, and if there seem to be patterns of abuses or whatever, I mean, then we can turn to individual citizens and give them the powers to bring lawsuits and so forth. But I think for the time being, I'm more comfortable just kind of leaving it in the hands of the professionals, the law enforcement. I can see a lot of havoc, you know, coming forth with remedies, lawsuits, frivolous lawsuits maybe, or maybe some that have, you know, are well-intentioned. But this can lead us to some areas I'd rather personally not go at the moment.
Any further questions? Any discussion? Mr. Neumeister, you want to testify on this amendment?
Also, if someone could get, I have a copy of 831 here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. In 2005, there was a compromise between Governor Pawlenty and at that time Attorney General Hatch that put the bill, what you have before you, the Delete Everything Amendment before you, all on Section 1 except the new language added is what the law was in 2005. It was delayed for 2 years. Last year the Attorney General came back with looking at the bill and said, hey, there are some things that were missed. One of them was the amendment and point that Senator Limmer just recently brought up. Secondly, was the issue of remedies. And I think it's important to share with you why remedies are very important. If you take a look at the current law and the current language, some of the things that what it does, it allows contractors to have access to information. Secondly, it starts to regulate information resellers, the Choice Points of the world, not just the CRAs, NexisLexis, which Mr. Tennyson represents, $100 who like to sell information about you and me who like to make money off that. Now, if you look at now the current law, what are the remedies? There are no criminal penalties. In 325E, it's not too clear whether or not the Attorney General would have what type of general power. And number three, we're taking away the individual to address themselves to a redress. Now, I just want to share with you what the GAO, which you're familiar with, is the General Accounting Office. And they have done some research on violations of Social Security numbers, and they have also talked about where some of the holes are nationally and statewide. Basically, in the GAO report, talks about stronger protections needed when contractors have access SSNs, some of the contractors who we're talking about here in the new additional language. It also talks about there are a lot of holes in the information resellers that have your Social Security number and when they sell it. Certain entities, such as information resellers, collect SSNs from public sources, private sources, and their customers and use this information for ID verification purposes. Federal law only applies to certain private sector entities, such as financial institutions, but all the other number of entities, there are big holes. Information resellers are not covered by these laws. New restrictions on abilities to obtain, use, and resell SN numbers. Vulnerabilities exist in federal law, and agency oversight for different industries
that share SSN numbers with their contractors and when information resellers do their business in selling. Tax preparers, telecommunication folks, and there are quite a number of folks who are involved in these kinds of things. We also need to realize that that Social Security number, once someone has that, last year, just alone, according to the FTC, 3,000 Minnesotans. This is just when complaints with the FTC. It doesn't, that does not include the hundreds or even thousands of folks that get from the Attorney General's office or folks who said, well, check with this, I'll look at my credit reporting, I'll try and minimize some of the breaches that may have happened. What a private entity will, what a private remedy will do and what 831 will do will as it follows. It is not clear what remedy or penalty in this matter. There may be an Attorney General's right of action, which I'm not clear on this 325. Experience has shown that a private right of action is necessary in order to ensure vigorous enforcement of the law. This law that we're going to be passing, we're going to make effective July 1st. While state and federal government are often consumed with pursuing other issues, and that has been the experience sometimes in our own Attorney General's office, and may be unable to pursue every indiscretion to the fullest extent of the law. Individuals are always motivated to vindicate their own rights. So if individuals here in this state, where they know that there's been a violation of their Social Security number, release of their information, or their game havoc for them, they should be able to have a remedy to protect their own privacy,
which does not
happen under this particular statute. The number of states that have this kind of thing, they range all the way from criminal penalties to the right to individually sue. There's about 15 to 20 states that have something about our SSN.
We're pretty silent
on that. And I take it, at least from the record, the Attorney General recognized that last year. And that section of law that is as the A4 was passed by one body. Not this body, because as you know, the chief author of that bill did not go forward. I'm suggesting that to adopt the A4 amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any further discussions on the A4 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
The only thing I might say is that I'm not sure if we need to have only in apparently the way this bill is written, it does recognize that there is a cause of action that the Attorney General could make. It's a jurisdictional opportunity for the Attorney General. However, I believe, and I think most of the Minnesota public probably agrees too, that they should have a right to protect their own credit history as well as their Social Security numbers from being transferred about this state, and not rely exclusively on a constitutional officer in the state of Minnesota. That if they feel that there's a loss that they've suffered, that they should be able to bring it to a courtroom and have their day in court. I don't think they need to rely on an Attorney General to bring that for them, that they in turn have a right to do that themselves. And there's always the possibility that perhaps a frivolous lawsuit might be written. There's a possibility that a frivolous lawsuit could be written in any area of our civil law. And I'm sure there's a reaction by the courts that if that would occur. And so I would recommend the A4 amendment for passage, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer renews his motion on the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
If I could just make a comment about this. The balance of interest in 8.31, and I have litigated under that statute, is that there are attorney's fees here, and vulnerable residents who couldn't otherwise bring a lawsuit now can find an attorney who can get paid for a violation, even though the damages to the person that was vulnerable and was harmed, even though they can't pay for a lawyer. Now there's a lawyer who can get paid to represent them, only if they can prove the case. The downside of that is there are a bunch of enterprising lawyers out there that will create niche markets for themselves. But when it comes to, we've proven in this state that there is identity theft, and it is a rampant problem, and there are vulnerable citizens and residents that are being violated and harmed by this. And so I think we should err on allowing those people to have a cause of action and to be able to hire an attorney and put some teeth into our statutes when we say we are trying to protect people and their privacy from these kinds of violations. I hope members will support Senator Limmer's and Mr. Neumeister's amendment here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, would Senator Betzold refresh my memory as to his thoughts on this?
Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not too crazy about the amendment. As I say, the law has not even gone into effect yet. I don't know the consequences and how much abuse there is going to be in selling or transferring Social Security numbers. I think it's in a trap for the unwary right now because there are businesses that probably are on the cusp that might violate the law, and I think that for the time being, I'm comfortable with having the Attorney General's office enforce the laws of the state of Minnesota. And once the law goes into effect, and we've had some chance to revisit it if we need to, or you know, have some familiarity with it, then if we see that there's enough reason to add a cause of action by private individuals, I think that's an appropriate debate. I think it's a little premature for a law that hasn't even gone into effect. So I think that right now is probably not the time to do it.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, I'm sure with the good quality of your witnesses, I would tend to think that if I asked them, they probably would say there's no problem with selling and transferring data like this between customers, that they wouldn't dare say, you know, there might be an abuse because they want this. But we haven't had much of a discussion in the event that there would be and how people could be harmed. And you know and I know and everyone else knows that Social Security numbers are vitally important to get very detailed information regarding people's finance records, sometimes their investments, certainly their medical records of their most intimate medical data. And Social Security numbers among are probably the most precious pieces of information that could reveal so much more about an individual. And because if it was done in a non-virtuous manner, conveyed to other people outside of a sale, that it could be great harm could come to individuals. We certainly have seen the examples of identity theft, and not only identity theft in and of itself, but the consequences of identity theft is the rack and ruin of many people. I just believe that in the event that there is an event that either through the intended misuse of Social Security numbers or the malicious use of Social Security numbers to perhaps ruin someone's credit or to abuse the purchase ability of them, that this type of law needs to have consequences and it needs to have teeth. And I believe that we can write all the privacy laws we want, but if you don't put teeth in them, then what protection do we really offer our citizens?
Well, just briefly, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Identity theft is a crime, and identity theft has ruined people's lives. There's no doubt about it, and I agree with what you've said. I think for the time being, I'd just as soon leave it in the hands of the prosecutors to enforce the laws and revisit the private right of action to a later date.
Senator Betzel, I understand that this the language that is before us has been negotiated over the summer among the different stakeholders. By potentially putting this amendment on, what does that do to, does that have an impact to undo?
Madam Chair, as I said, I promised that I would work on this issue. There have been many meetings that I did not take place with. I have met with a number of them prior to the start of the session. I always obviously reserve the right to present the bill as I see fit. And what was presented to me, I think I was comfortable with, and the deletions I was also comfortable with. So, but ultimately, I don't know what caused the groups to not want this in there, but as I say, my inclination is I don't think I need it in the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, in our discussion, there was a reference to a compromise between stakeholders. We haven't had a discussion of who those stakeholders are. Are they all businesses? Are there consumer protection rights people involved in this? Tell me a little bit more about this group that's intending. The term compromise has been used, but I'm not sure if that's an accurate one. Usually compromises between two opposing parties, and I don't know if there's opposing parties in this. I think it's more of a kind of a list of corporations that want to have freedom to exercise the conveyance of Social Security numbers in order to transact an extended transaction of some sort so they can legitimately do that without getting into unintended consequences. But I don't think compromise would be perhaps an accurate word. Could you correct me if I'm wrong?
Well, Senator Betzel. I don't know who all participated in what meetings. I know that I invited anybody who had an interest in this to meet with me, I think, in January up in room 112, and we packed the room. You know, and it wasn't just, I mean, there were people that are truly interested in this topic. It crosses a lot of interests here. So, and frankly, if you can get that kind of a turnout and not have everybody, you know, and people are generally okay with the language, I think that, you know, I recognize that, you know, people must have reached some sort of accord that I'm okay with, and apparently a lot of groups, I recognize Mr. Neumeister may not agree with this, but, you know, this is what the process is all about.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, if we had all of the people in the room that wanted one thing, and they wanted to write a new version of what was around last year, you might have a court in the room, but it may not be the best law to protect our citizens from a potential misuse of the law. I think that's probably our job.
Well, Madam Chair, that's my job, too, as a chief author. That's why I made it clear to all of them. I said, you may come back to the agreement, but you've still got to meet my approval, too. So.
Yeah.
Well, Senator Lummer renews his motion on the A4 amendment. A roll call has been requested.
Betzel?
No.
Foley?
Oh.
Higgins?
No.
Lummer?
Aye.
Moi?
No.
Olson?
No.
Ortman?
Aye.
Pariso?
Aye.
Scheid?
No.
The motion does not prevail on a vote of 3 ayes and 6 nays. Senator Betzel.
Chair, I don't know if anybody else here wants to be heard.
There's just one other part of the bill I wanted to address in my testimony.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, two out of the three emphases of my testimony have been dealt with. One is, if you look on line or page 214, where it says at the end of the sentence, Social Security number is initially collected for the purpose of identifying the individual. I would like to suggest the following language. Any transfer or disclosure must be made in a secure manner that protects the Social Security number. So one of the things that we've seen what happens, again, and when information resellers, this little section is not just for credit reporting agencies. It's basically for people that are in the business of selling Social Security numbers, which is very broad. So I'm just trying to direct that any transfer or disclosure must be made in a secure manner that protects the Social Security number. And that would be after of identifying the individual, period. And, Madam Chair, this bill
yes, a lot of stakeholders, and I participated over the years. There really has not been a consistent consumer protection kind of consistency. A lot of the stakeholder meetings, and I went to a couple of them last year, they're basically a lot of businesses, a lot of folks who have a real strong interest in the Social Security number from one perspective. As I have always, Madam Chair, in this committee, traditionally have tried to share sometimes other perspectives that sometimes are not heard. Even in a joking kind of way, I said, can I join the Fair Information Practices group or whatever? That they have their point of view, and it was they sort of laughed because they knew I come from a different perspective than what those folks may do. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a comment, and then the third point that I did bring up.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not going to move that language because, again, I think that language is precisely the kind that would might be read to, again, deprive Minnesota citizens of getting reports. I think we tried to strike a balance with, you know, protecting it and recognizing there's reasonable exceptions. If you look at the bottom of page 1, lines 23 forward, that, you know how information can be mailed or cannot be mailed. If you look at page 2, line 15, starting with that language, we recognize that there's just levels of security and permissive language, and I think that Mr. Neumeister's suggestion I think causes further confusion. So unless there is any further discussion, Madam Chair, I don't think this bill has to go anywhere else. I would move that to Senate File 2390. First engrossment, or as amended, because it was amended by this committee, be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor.
Any further discussions? On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Rust. Senator Rust, do you want to do 2607 first?
She is. I've been looking for her.
She's been here for quite a while.
She was hiding back there. I need to go to Capitol Hill.
Okay.
What if they need me? They'll notify me.
All righty.
Okay. I don't know if she's national. I don't think so. I think the controversy's out of her bill.
That was a lively discussion.
Senator Ress, 2607.
2607 first, okay. 2607 is a bill that was developed by Representative Pawlowski in the House, who is my counterpart in terms of a House chair for government operations, working during the interim with the governor's office on a proposal for how state agencies would be called upon to operate when there is a natural disaster and the president has made a disaster declaration.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
I apologize for interrupting. I can't hear a word you're saying. I'm sorry, Madam.
I'm eating the microphone, so I'm not sure how much more I can do.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Ress.
The bill provides for how state agencies would operate during a period when the president has declared a natural disaster, made that kind of declaration. Representative Pawlowski, my counterpart in the House, was working with representatives of the agencies, the governor's office, to come up with an overall plan. It doesn't have any money in it. It just talks about the kinds of things that would be appropriate for each of the state agencies, and there are 13 plus the Department of Finance that would be called upon to act in the instance of a federal disaster declaration, and in particular the way in which state resources would be used, so non-FEMA resources. This does not apply to them. The instance for what I believe occasioned the bill to come to the Judiciary Committee is in Section 3, Subdivision 3, would draw your attention to the role of the Department of Public Safety in that section. And then, let's see, where is it again? And then in Section 15. So if you want to look, look there. The Department of Public Safety in particular would be, in under that first Section 3, would be required to disperse state matching funds to eligible entities. And it also specifies then that the state funds that are dispersed for FEMA eligible costs are in advance and must be repaid with federal dollars to the appropriate state fund. And then again in Section 15, the Department of Public Safety there, there's an authorization for the use of state disaster appropriations for the state match for federal disaster assistance that allows the use of state appropriations to pay for the local match up to the level that would be set in law. And it requires bond appropriations to be used for the state's share of capital costs. And it authorizes the commissioner to make grants to counties for disaster-related debris removal and burial from homes and farms with the documentation of costs.
Any questions for Senator Ress? Senator Ress, the gist of it is that we're creating a new chapter in the law. Yes, that's what this does?
That would set in place, doesn't make the appropriations. It says the guidelines under which appropriations would be made of state funds that are non-FEMA funds, so that the chaos or confusion, maybe not chaos, but confusion about what actually could be done that we have seen with recent natural disasters, that people would find some structure for what was going to be covered and who was going to be doing what. Madam Chair, there was, from the Department of Health, there was a request to add in the section for them an amendment that added their responsibility for food safety, lodging, and shelter. I understand from your committee administrator that you would be amenable to adding that amendment here, even though it's not your jurisdiction. If you don't want to, we can do it in finance, where the bill has to go next. But it's a very simple amendment.
Senator Ress, this is the first time that the bill is coming before a committee, or did it already come from somewhere else?
No, it's already been to state and local.
To another one, okay. I think that we're okay with putting this language on, if members don't object.
And Madam Chair, I'm on Senator Ress' committee, and we heard it there, and there was no problem. So I'll move the AO8-1166 amendment.
Any further discussions on that amendment? And Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Anybody here to testify either for or against Senate File 2607? See none. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I had a couple questions on the bill, if I could. I noticed that we are waiving everything under the sun, and I was curious, Did we do those same sort of waivers for the Southeast Minnesota floods
when we were
without this actual authorization? We just did them kind of automatically.
Senator Rest,
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, it's my understanding that that rules were waived and so forth in order to attempt at least to get the aid to the people as quickly as possible.
And Madam
Chair,
Senator
Higgins,
Senator Rest, and you're comfortable with. With putting those waivers into a kind of a more formalized setting?
Senator Rest?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, I am, to the extent that we're dealing with a disaster.
Okay. And then, Madam
Senator
Chair
Higgins.
Senator Rest, I think my other question was on line 6.2, where the housing finance, the challenge grant funds can be used, and the loans are forgiven for owner-occupied housing if the homeowner continues to live there for some amount of time, and then the loans are forgiven for rental properties if the rents remain affordable to the local workforce. And affordable according to whom, I guess, is my question. Because affordable changes, I think, in every jurisdiction pretty much. I mean, are we affordable to the lawyers and doctors, or are we affordable to the nurses and, those folks?
The
Senator Rest.
I think that what is going to happen there, again, this is a guideline, is that the actual legislation would state what affordable means when a bill is presented for an appropriation, if that's possible.
Okay.
So this is, again, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, it's a framework rather than trying to detail what the actual law that we would pass in order to get this assistance out, or forgiveness of loans, or determining affordability, whatever would be appropriate at that time.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, I just had
Senator
one other
Higgins.
Comment. I notice a fair number of grammar and punctuation and spelling sort of things, and so rather than me going through them and taking everyone's time, can we just ask our esteemed attorneys to fix those as they prepare the bill for the next go-round.
What a
And Senator Higgins, perhaps you would like to give that feedback to Senator Rest, and then an amendment could be prepared for technical corrections once it goes to the Finance Committee.
Or, Madam Chair, often what we've done is the staff just, if they see weird things that they know aren't correct, they just fix them as they go without, if we give them kind of the direction to go to, and I think that might be just as easy a way to do it. If you want some samples, I can point them out, but you probably don't. So,
Senator Rest.
I'd be interested to know, where the reviser went wrong in this bill. So if Senator Higgins would point out a couple of them, that'd be helpful to me.
Okay, on line 2.8, there's a couple of very random semicolons that ought to just be commas. This committee has heard me rant about these for quite a while. And on 5.12, there's a colon just stuck in there that can just be deleted with no harm, no foul.
Aren't these just subject to flogging?
Flogging would be good. And I apologize. I mean, this is what I do in my other life for 30 years.
Bring the reviser to us.
Yeah. In my next life, I'm going to be the reviser. Yes.
Well, actually,
Senator Rest,
we can do that, but I would suggest that with in 5.12, actually, Senator Higgins, what should be done there is after the of, insert the following, because what we have is a list of things that should be separated by semicolons, and not commas, because they are more than one or two word phrases, which would call for semicolons to separate them.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, more than the number of words does not become the determiner. It's whether there's an and internal to the or another piece of punctuation internal. But your
and there are those.
And here we are.
There.
We did this for hours
one
the other
in
night.
There, Senator Higgins at 5:15. But
right,
the committee
right.
Can
so
do
the semicolons in this instance are correct. Yeah. It's the colon on 5.12 that's incorrect, and your suggestion is just as good as taking the colon out.
Senator Higgins moves that on line 5.12. After the word of, insert the following.
That works, too.
Any further discussions?
Or you can just take the comma out.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Heretic. I think, Madam Chair, I will consult with the council about the correcting the punctuation.
Thank
and
you.
Or just whatever other irregularities there are that the reviser did with the bill.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2607, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? Did I already ask if anybody's here to testify for or against this bill? Very good. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Rest, Senate File 2402.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is an amendment that you will want to consider, the, I believe, the A2 amendment that I've worked with your Senate counsel on that addresses, again, some of the issues that are for the Judiciary Committee. What Senate File 20, and it is the A2 amendment, what Senate File 2402 is about is modernizing the Board of Accountancy statutes to reflect the changes that have been made over the past several years to the Uniform Accountancy Act, and the and it involves some definitions. It involves the mobility of a CPA license from state to state. It involves being able to sit for the CPA exam prior to completing the education requirements that we put in place several years ago, and it also involves some of the authority of the Board of Accountancy with regard to supervision of the members of the CPA profession. It also provides that certificates that have been issued for 1 year will now be issued for 3 years in terms of the licensing. The judiciary issues are in Section 19, Subdivision 2, Section 21, Subdivision 5, and Section 28, Paragraph D. The amendment, in terms of the issues that were called to the, our attention, is in, if you look at page 1, line 9, to insert there a technical amendment dealing with the data that are relating to the disciplinary proceedings. And there was a section in the bill also that stated that the hearings would be private data, and of course that's an absurdity. So with the council working with the Board of Accountancy representatives devised lines 1 through 9, 1-9 through 1-15 to indicate that the disciplinary hearing would be a closed to the public, and then that the record and the findings would be private data on individuals until the board had issued its final order, and to delete then on page 16 of the bill the language that was in the original bill relating to that that issue.
Members, I believe that what this does is it puts in place language to make the Board of Accountancy's practices sort of in line with the other licensing boards. Is that correct, Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair and members, I know a number of boards have this kind of, I think like the Board of Medical Practice, I think, has similar language. I think the rules of the Supreme Court have similar rules with respect to like attorney disciplinary proceedings. I'm not sure, as far as a lot of other boards, how many do or don't come under this kind of protection.
And I guess, the question is, you know, this board, I think what they were aiming for is to go in this direction. And what we're just doing is clarifying it to make it more concrete so that it's more in line with the others. Senator Ress, is that your
That's
intent?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Very good.
And we appreciate counsel's advice on this.
Yes. So the A2 amendment. Any questions on the A2 amendment?
Chair, Senator Betzel. I'll move the amendment, and just as a notation, too. It used to be virtually everything classifying data was in Chapter 13. It just got to be too complicated for people because they'd read a section of law and not check to see if Chapter 13 had something. So we migrated some of these specific classifications out of Chapter 13, but we still want to keep cross-references within Chapter 13. So if you want to look within the Data Practices Act, as lines 1.5 to 1.7 do in this amendment, you can see that there's amendment. But if you really want to find the substance of it, you should go to the pertinent chapter. So that's just so people understand. This is consistent with what we've done in the past. So
very good. On the A2,
I'll move the A2 amendment.
On the A2 amendment is moved by Senator Betzel. Is anybody in the audience who's here to testify either for or against this amendment? On Senator Betzel's motion on the A2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And, Madam Chair, the other issue unresolved that the Senate counsel had drawn attention to was on page 18, lines 26 through 28, where we are, where the bill proposes this long string of actions that for which the Board of Accountancy could discipline a CPA. And there was a, even though the term moral turpitude is used a number of other places in the statutes, that somehow it was jarring, suggested here. And I know that counsel and the representatives from the Board of Accountancy, CPA Society, had tried to come up with a substitute that would be meaningful and clear and so forth. There really doesn't seem to be one. And my suggestion would either be to leave it as it is or just remove it. The whole lines 18, 26, 27, and 28. They have engaged in disciplinary actions without those three lines for
a while.
Yeah, a very long time.
Yes.
And if the committee sees any objections to those terms, although, again, it's not a term that does not exist in statute. It certainly does. But it's okay. We would not object.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Rest. If it exists other places in statutes, is it defined somewhere? Because, or is it defined in case law? Because I wouldn't even have a good idea what they're talking about as far as you know, that moral standards tend to evolve over time, and so something that might be considered a crime of moral turpitude 50 years ago isn't necessarily today. So I also kind of see a problem with that language as being really subjective.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, I believe it's used in 19 different statutes in current law, Senator Ress alluded to, most often licensing provisions such as this. My understanding is it's not defined anywhere. I looked through them all briefly, didn't find any definitions, and we asked our law clerk in Senate Council to look in Minnesota case law, and he couldn't find any clear definitions either. So it's, you know, it's kind of a broad term that means, I guess, whatever the particular board wants it to mean in that situation.
Madam Chair,
it's an arrest.
We understand that the it is on occasion, depending on the circumstances, defined by the courts, and it is defined in federal law. But if the committee is uncomfortable about inserting another use of it in this statute, we are indifferent.
Senator Olson moves to delete. Senator Olson moves the A3 amendment. Senator Olson. Any further discussion?
The A3 amendment.
Does that. Okay. Deletes the new language on page 18 from line 26 through 28, I believe.
I need to see the amendment before I know.
Senator Russ, have you seen the language?
I've already said I'm comfortable with it.
Okay. Any discussions on Senator Olson's amendment? Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against this amendment? See none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Russ, is Mr. Hyde going to be testifying on the bill or making a comment?
Madam Chair, if you have questions of him, certainly he can, but he doesn't need to.
Okay. Mr. Hyde, I have one question. In Section 21, there's a whole list of different things that is in current law, except for the provision of new language that was proposed that was just deleted out. But it was interesting to see that giving all the different things that you could look at to whether or not, you know, you refuse to renew or suspend or temporarily suspend or revoke somebody's license or application, that there's such a low threshold for that, and that it's a preponderance of the evidence and that's presented. How often or how many cases do you have coming before you that this action needs to be taken?
Perhaps not a great deal. I mean, okay, excuse me. My name is Robert Hyde. I'm a member of the State Board of Accountancy and chair of the Rules and Legislation Committee. I'm not 100% sure, Madam Chair, if I understand your question. We do have a lot of cases that there are a lot of disciplinary matters that the board does hear. I would say most of them do not involve these particular items that are listed here. Some of them are just simply the licensing issues, the renewal issues, the CPE issues. But these are all the ones that are currently listed here that we did not change are pretty much what's included in the Model Uniform Accountancy Act that's really been adopted nationwide. And those are the kinds of things, any one of which could be very important at a particular moment in time, depending on the situation. I have a feeling I didn't quite answer your question.
Well, I was struck that preponderance of the evidence is such a low standard when we look at, examining evidence to impose a sanction on somebody. And so I just wondered if if that standard is low because there aren't a lot of cases, and usually it's pretty egregious when somebody gets there, or because I do have some concerns given all the conversations that this committee has been engaged in about collateral sanctions and people not being having an opportunity to get licensed or be able to move on with their lives given the kind of maybe things that they may have done in the past. And I'm wondering, I'm just bringing this up for the committee members. I was struck at maybe should that threshold be a little bit higher, or are we comfortable with the lowness of that threshold? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as long as you brought up an issue that we're talking about kind of more generally, I just share with this committee that in my community over the last number of months, not with this particular administrative board, but we've had a veterinarian whose license was being dealt with by that board, and over an incident that he challenged them on quite significantly and became very public about his concerns about that board's authority to impose fines, and him, the fact that he didn't have any remedy to a trial by jury or the judicial system. In fact, his livelihood could be taken away and quite significant fines imposed without the type of due process that we would normally expect our criminal system to have, our judicial system, I guess I should say, to have. And the fact, in his opinion at least, that the board's actions were motivated more by the fact that he was challenging them publicly rather than the underlying incident. And so I think that does kind of raise a bigger issue that I've been thinking about more in terms of the power that administrative boards have, and being cautious that they do at least have some due process requirements built into the actions that they take.
Mr. Hyde.
I think I understand your question a little more fully now. We have had this discussion when we were reviewing our statutes with our Attorney General. And I think we were talking about the different levels of evidence that we needed. And I think, he's not here to answer on our behalf, but I think he was comfortable with that as being the appropriate level. I might be using the incorrect words here. But
he, Mr. Hyde, the representative from the Attorney General's
attorney,
office.
Our attorney.
Your attorney.
Our attorney for the board.
Okay.
Board of Accountancy.
Is a deputy attorney general.
A deputy attorney general. Okay. And so, I kind of caught me a little bit off guard on this conversation a little bit, but...
So there was some conversation about the threshold level of evidence.
Yeah. And I don't believe we have had, like Senator Olson, where we don't take arbitrary action. We certainly wouldn't take action because somebody is challenging, our position on the board. We're just not that way, And so generally our cases are pretty clear cut, and we wouldn't do that, I don't believe.
Council, do we know what in other boards, what the threshold level of evidence is in other boards? Do you happen to know that? I mean, I don't expect that you have the information.
Madam Chair, I would guess that it either doesn't specify it or that it might say preponderance over the evidence. I'm not aware of any that would use something like clear and convincing. Mm. Frequently, I think it'll just say if the board finds that, and then you sort of assume it's preponderance of the evidence. And frequently, these will be conducted as contested case hearings.
Yes, it would go. So. Yeah.
Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, she's correct. In the event, the ultimate sanction would be the revoking of a license in our particular instance, and that does result in a hearing before the administrative law judge in a contested case matter.
So, Mr. Hyde, there is an appeals process built into?
Yes. Well, the appeals process is under the Chapter 14. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay. That we do have to go to Chapter 14 in order to actually revoke a certificate in a contested case, and it would be heard before the administrative law judge.
Mr. Mahide, I might invite your invitation, invite you to engage in a conversation about not just your board, but other boards with respect to this threshold level at a future date.
You had a very good question.
Yeah. But
I would have thought about it more had I known it.
We won't pick on you today, but this is a kind of a dangling question that's out there. And we invite you to think about it, and we'll probably have you back to talk to us about it.
Be happy.
Thanks. Any further questions for Senator Rest? Any other questions on Senate File 2402? Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2402, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Anybody here to testify for or against the bill before I call for the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Ress. Senator Moore. Thank you, Madam Chair. You have in front of you Senate file, I don't even remember the Senate file number now.
2642.
And Madam Chair, members, there's a A2 delete all amendment to put the bill in the shape that I would like it to be in. I move the A2 amendment.
Senator Moore has moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Members, I think last year we created, was it last year? In 2006, we created a great program called the Safe at Home Program to protect individuals who need their to be protected. And what this bill does is it helps to clarify some items in the law. So if you look at the A2 amendment, the language of the A2 amendment, Section 1 of the A2 amendment defines or clarifies what mail needs to be forwarded to program participants. And it specifically says that the items that will be forwarded are letters and flats, large envelopes that are sent by first-class mail, items that clearly indicate that they are sent by government agencies, and clearly mark pharmaceuticals, but we are explicitly excluding packages, parcels, periodicals, and catalogs, and it really is... it's just not sustainable for us to forward everything. So we're trying to clarify and exclude out what is not going to be forwarded. We think that in terms of the packages and parcels and periodicals, the participants would find other ways to get that those items to them. And so we want to define what mail is that will be forwarded. In Section 2 of the amendment, now the bill, we are asking for participants to give the Secretary of State consent to confirm participation in the program to those who provide a participant's name and the lot number that the Secretary of State's office has assigned to them. And we also request that participants provide other information required by the Secretary of State. Under current law, we say that they will consent for the release of information. Under current law, we're not as explicit, and so we're giving the participants, the Secretary of State, the opportunity to get consent from the participant. Section 3 of the law modifies the consent for release of information. Under current law, we say that a consent for release of information is not valid. And now what we're correcting is that a consent for release of the address is invalid, so that we can have the consent that they give to the Secretary of State to confirm information that
confirmation or that consent could be used by the Secretary of State. Section 3, Subdivision 2, so that was Subdivision 1. Section 3, Subdivision 2 is probably the most substantive change that we've made to the bill since its introduction. It creates a process for safe-at-home staff to provide data about participants to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and for them to provide it to law enforcement when it's needed to respond to an emergency situation or a criminal complaint or an investigation. Our rationale is that law enforcement and the BCA have agreed to this process, which balances the protection of participant data. But we recognize the need of law enforcement to perhaps access the information. And then Section 4 pertains to data on the Safe at Home program participants, and it states that the data released... Forget what I just said in Section 4. Section 5, 6, and 7 is also another addition to the Safe at Home program, which allows the participants to use their ID, their P.O. box, as their address and their driver's license cards. So that they don't have to compromise their home address or their location on their driver's licenses. And that's the gist of the Delete All Amendment and the bill. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Moore. Do the members have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel?
This bill may have to go to state and local government. I would take it because of the election issues.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I believe that it has to go to transportation. But if you...
Okay.
I'm not aware the state and local have asked for this.
Well, Madam Chair, elections issues, I don't know if it has to go there or not. But I do... refresh me, Ms. Fraser, on this. The Safe at Home program, obviously, is so someone doesn't have to... They can vote, but they're not disclosing their real address in the Secretary of State. But how was that done, for instance... Obviously, anybody can vote in a statewide race for governor, constitutional officer, president, U.S. senator. But are they assigned to some other area, for instance, a congressional district that they may not live in, or a legislative race or a city race? Are they voting in areas, do they get ballots that they're not really within the jurisdiction that they can vote on?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, for the record, my name is Beth Fraser, and I'm with the Secretary of State's office. The Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program is actually much broader than voting, and I will answer your question, but just to give a little bit of context, the program provides participants a way to live more normal lives, even if they're trying to hide from their abuser. So we give them a post office box. They give it out as their address in almost all public and private situations, and then we get all of their mail and forward it to them. In terms of voting, which is addressed in the underlying statute, 5B, we know where they really live and request ballots. The Secretary of State's office requests ballots from the local appropriate county auditor, who then sends the ballots to us. We send them to the participants. They send them back to us. We do the signature match because it's an absentee ballot, verify that it is from the appropriate person, and then remove any identifying information and return it to the appropriate county auditor, where it's then transferred to the precinct.
Do the members have any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Ms. Fraser, has your office, Secretary of State's office, given any thought to how this might be abused under just the voting provision? Could someone abuse it in some way, vote in a different precinct than where they should? If your name happened to be Mary Olson, does it happen to be, if there's more than one Mary Olson, could they take on the identity of someone else? How would that be prevented?
Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer, I don't think that the issue of having a similar name would be a problem, especially in terms of voting in the wrong precinct. We will be receiving mail for these individuals and forwarding it to them several times a week. And so we will always know where they live and exactly which precinct in which they live.
And Madam Chair,
Sarah Limmer.
When one takes on their mail responsibility, is this their day-to-day mail? Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes.
And is there a requirement that they have to show that they're being abused or show in some way that they've hit a threshold that would qualify them for this treatment?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the way that the program works is that in order to enroll in the program, you have to meet with an application assistant who we have trained. They're primarily individuals working with battered women shelters or other victim service programs. You have to sit down with them, talk about a safety plan and whether this is a good fit for you. And then you have to fill out the application on which you certify that you either are a survivor of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, or that you otherwise fear for your safety.
Okay, Madam Chair, is that
Senator Limmer?
Is that predicated on perhaps a court hearing or a police report? Or is that just someone saying, I've been abused by someone?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, there is not a requirement that there be a court order or a police report. The participants do self-certify. Being in the program is not a luxury in any way. I mean, you have to wait for all of your mail. You have to hide where you are. You can't tell anyone where you really live. We believe that the burdens of participation will screen out people for whom it's not really needed.
Senator Limmer?
I'm just trying to let me just give you a scenario. let's say there was in my Senate district 5,000 people that wanted to avail themselves of this program, and they went to your office and simply said, I'm abused, and I want to avail myself of this. And you included them in the program. And if there was any question of a voting discrepancy, how would we know?
Ms. Fraser?
With that big of a population.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. Well, first, again, they wouldn't come through our office. They would sit down with the application assistants and have to convince them that this was a good fit for them. And 5,000 is more than we ever expect to have in the program. But were that to happen, we would process the ballots, as I explained before. We send them mail. We know exactly where they live. And once we transfer the ballots back to the county auditor, who sends them to the precinct, there's a certification on the ballot that we have filled out that states that this is a ballot sent in by a Safe at Home participant, that we've done the signature match, and we indicate on there whether the signatures matched or did not match, and the election judges are required to accept the ballot based upon whether or not the signatures matched.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
One last question, and I kind of recall this, but I just wanted, I don't know if I heard it. Are other states using similar programs? We're not the first one, are we?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, no, we are not the first state. There are about 20 other states. Washington State has had a similar program for about 16 years.
Okay.
And Ms. Fraser, I guess I would just, this isn't really a question but a comment. I would think that this program would allow women to make a choice. I know that there are some women who are afraid of using the processes we have available under the court system. No matter how safe we try to make them, sometimes they know the abuser best, and whether an OFP or going through the court system is likely to cause that person to become more dangerous, and that protecting their identity in whatever way we can enable them to do is sometimes is the best way we can help them. So, Senator Moi, are you ready to move your bill?
If there are no more questions, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 2642, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Transportation Committee.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Are we adjourned?
Adjourned.
See, my little budget is